Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the meeting to discuss the second revised draw proposal. This is for the Transmission Access Charge Options Initiative. My name is Christina Osborne. I work in the Stakeholder Process Group. Also, the primary presenter today is Lorenzo Christov. He's from the Policy Group. He's going to review the proposal and kind of do a discussion of if you'll follow a sequence of topics in the paper. What we'll do is we'll break for lunch for 45 minutes so that we can stay on schedule. And when we return, Lorenzo will continue the discussion on the revised draw proposal, and then we'll go over the next steps for the initiative. We did put out a revised draw proposal in, I think, May 20th, and we held a stakeholder meeting. We received lots of comments on the proposal. So then we also held a working group meeting on August 11th, and that was on the region-wide wheeling access charge and default cost allocation, and we received a lot of stakeholder comments on that as well. So we just published the second revised draw proposal on September 30th. After this meeting, we are going to ask that stakeholders provide written comments on the proposal and discussion that we have today. Those are going to be due October 28th. You can submit those to the initiative comments at cao.com mailbox. The presentation that we're reviewing today was posted early yesterday morning, and also an addendum that includes responses to stakeholder comments on draw proposals. So those are available on the initiative webpage. We will be taking questions throughout the day, so if you have a question in the room, you can raise your hand. Just a reminder to please state your name and affiliation before asking your question or making your comment. People on the web would greatly appreciate it, and that also goes for the folks on the web. If you have a question and you're on the web, you can press pound 2 on your telephone, and that will place you in the queue. So at this time, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Lorenzo.
All right, thank you, Christina. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being here bright and early on a Friday morning. We'll try to get you out at a reasonable time. As you are aware, this initiative has been going on for a while. It was last October was the very first issue paper we put out. So we've gone through several iterations till then. And in what we've put out most recently, I think we have responded to many of the things that you told us. And so I hope we're moving in the right direction. So I'm going to basically follow the outline of the way materials organized in the paper. The first section was called Key Terms, Concepts, and Assumptions. And I guess before we even get to what's in the paper, just as a quick refresher of the basics, what this is all about is that for the ISO balancing authority area, we are in charge of operations of facilities that are turned over to us by our participating transmission owners. These are the entities that transmission facilities. They give them over to our operational control, but they continue to own those assets and be responsible for the physical maintenance of them. We're operating from our control room and operating a market, a wholesale spot market that's integrated with the operation of the system. But the physical assets themselves have associated with them a revenue requirement that needs to be recovered annually called transmission revenue requirements. Each participating transmission owner has a TRR, a dollar amount that's approved by FERC, and the ISO collects that. At least we collect it for the high voltage facilities, facilities above 200 kV, collect it through our settlement process, and then we give money back to the participating transmission owners. The mechanism that we use for collecting it is called transmission access charge. So that's what this is about. The structure and definition of that we pretty much take for granted, which I'll go over. But once we start thinking about expanding to a larger balancing authority area than we have today by bringing in a large new PTO, for example, PacifiCorp, then questions arise as to, well, who pays for which resources? And when we structure the TAC, is it the same rate across the system, or should it be different in different areas? That was the question we started with a year ago. Today, for the high voltage revenue requirements, the ISO footprint has a single postage stamp rate, we call it, which is the same wherever you are in the system. And then, for low voltage facilities, recovering those revenue requirements is done through a PTO-specific rate for the service territories of the big investor-owned utilities, PG&E, Southern Cal Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric. What we are starting from is that existing structure as we look forward to a larger balancing authority area. Then we're sticking with the assumption that low voltage will be collected the way it is today. And that brings me into the first slide, which are some of the basics of what we're using to define the scope of this initiative. One, we're talking about cost allocation for high voltage facilities, that's the 200 kV and above, with the assumption that for the local, that's terminology of Order 1000, local low-voltage facilities under ISO operational control, that'll be recovered from PTO-specific rates. Now, PTO-specific really does refer to the territories of the three big investor-owned utilities, so that those PTO-specific rates are collected essentially from all the entities who are serving their load within those three territories. We use the term CAISO. We wanted to distinguish in the paper to make it as clear as possible. So when we put the CA in front of it, we're referring to our existing footprint. And when we use expanded ISO, we'll use that phrase, or sometimes it says expanded BAA. People have started to use the term regional ISO, so all of these terms are really meant to be equivalent. We probably need to standardize on our terminology, and we'll get to that. But usually acronyms come first, so we haven't figured out the right acronym yet. But in any event, that's the idea. And then PTO number one is really the first significant PTO that joins to form the expanded ISO. By significant, specifically what we're saying is that this new PTO has a load service territory. We've had new PTOs join the ISO by virtue of building transmission under competitive solicitation. Entities that win a competitive solicitation to build, own, operate, maintain a transmission facility that's turned over to ISO operational control become PTOs under our tariff. But they also don't have a load service territory. They're simply an operator of a facility. So we're not talking about adding more of them, which we may do, but we are talking about now a new service territory becoming part of the larger balancing authority area. So PTO number one is general idea for whoever is first. PacifiCorp is closest to the gate at this point. But so page six, slide six. New transmission facilities are those planned and approved through a new integrated TPP for the expanded ISO. TPP stands for Transmission Planning Process. And the way we think about an expanded TPP is that it addresses the entire service area that's ISO operational control, including the new PTO as well as the existing footprint. Our current TPP, and I'll go through some more detail about that shortly, but our current planning process is a 15-month process that runs annually. So the cycles overlap a little bit. Starts in January and goes till the end of March following year, which is where a final comprehensive plan is presented to the board for their approval. So the sense is that once this new PTO number one is fully integrated, that is, we're operating as a single balancing authority area, that's when we would start the first iteration of the expanded TPP. So, for example, if PacifiCorp is fully integrated, we start operation on January 1st of 20, say, then January 2020 would also be when we would start the first iteration of the new transmission planning process. So new facilities are ones that are planned through that process. Note that also there may be projects under consideration right now as interregional, because currently if we want to plan something in conjunction with PacifiCorp or one of the parties outside of the ISO footprint, each of them is part of a planning region consistent with the requirements of FERC Order 1000, and so we have some rules that enable some consideration of interregional projects between the ISO region and a neighboring region. So there may be projects under consideration in that venue that later on may be considered as potential projects under our planning process. And I'll get into more of the details of that in a moment. Yeah, Dave.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. And I had a couple questions around the concept of existing and new.
Sure.
I don't know if now's the right time. I know you're going to get into it.
Well, let me just say existing, and then you can ask, because item F is existing. Let me just mention that for the benefit of everyone. So existing facilities are basically those placed under ISO operational control that are not new. In earlier definitions, we had a few more stipulations about distinguishing these categories, and we got a lot of comments that urged greater simplicity. So we tried here, and I think we have something that works, that says, let's simplify this. If it's going to be in the new category, it's got to be planned through this new integrated planning process for the whole region. If it doesn't come out of that planning process, then it's existing. It's whatever parties bring to the table. Even if it's not in service yet, it could still be in progress, under construction, whatever. But the fact that it was planned by the separate PTO or by the ISO, CAISO separately, for its own area makes it existing. So go ahead, Dave.
Thank you. Again, it's Dave Smith with Transwest Express. And some of the questions I have are kind of follow-up to comments that we've made already, and I haven't seen it, you know, positively addressed yet in the work since we've provided these comments. So that's why I want to ask these.
Go ahead. That's fine. Thanks.
In the explanation of why the existing is the way it is or so, in your second draft, you say that, you know, this will mitigate the risk of incentivizing PTOs to develop costly projects ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is that something you're trying to prevent? Or why is that a concern of yours? Or did other stakeholders raise that? Or?
Well, the idea is that if we wanted to define a bright line between these categories, then a principle that seems to make sense would be that if potentially the costs are going to be shared across multiple subregions, then all of the parties should be part of the process that decides that that project is going to go forward through the comprehensive plan. So that's sort of the basic rule. Things that are outside of that then would be one entity's decision about what it needs for its system, mm-hmm. that may or may not be what a comprehensive plan would have produced.
Right, and we made the comment earlier that that the existing process needs to be in place to support the future expanded. Mm-hmm. And you're addressing that by saying interregional projects can kind of get folded into expanded. When you think of large projects being developed by a PTO that's thinking of joining it, I can't help but think of the gateway projects, mm-hmm. that today are currently going through the NTTG process and are really not being looked at by the ISO or others as potential projects. And I think that the ISO has to rethink that and start considering those projects as potential interregional projects, even though it doesn't fit the FERC 1000 definition, mm-hmm. because those gateway projects were also put forward as the transmission solution in the SB 350 study. And I appreciate that the SB 350 study was not a transmission process, right. But when you start calculating billions of dollars of savings and you start throwing in billion-dollar transmission projects into that study, it seems like, you know, and I think it's right to be looking at those projects and other projects today. Mm-hmm. And looking at them as either, I call them potential interregional projects. I'll just call them projects that California may pay a portion of. Mm-hmm. Just as, you know.
Okay.
So, and I think if the ISO waits until the expanded happens, now it could happen or it may not happen, right? It's still subject. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very likely that it will happen, so that's fine. But it's not likely it's going to happen next year or the year after or the year after. Currently, the state policy for California has a 50% RPS by 2030, and that includes a 40% RPS goal by 2024. That's in this cycle's planning horizon. And if you're not looking at those projects now, I'm not sure what you're accomplishing all that you're trying to mitigate here.
Okay.
And so I think that has to be, you know, I don't know if it's right to address it in the TAC options piece. I think an element of it is right. But it's also the way that the ISO is conducting its current TPP and other things. So can a regional project that's being looked at today by NTTG, the Gateway Projects, fit into this new? Or are you saying because it's being looked at by another process now, it really can't be brought forward? I don't think that's the correct solution, but I'm just
according to the definition,
ISO has to be involved in that review now,
right.
Not later.
Well, a couple of things, and we'll get into this in more detail when I get into the section that talks about how our transmission planning process works. With the definition I'm putting in front of you now, it can't be new until we initiate this expanded TPP. So, you know, the answer to that part of your question is we can't look at it as part of our transmission planning process in the normal way. We can under the provisions we've set up for looking at interregional projects, and I understand that may not be satisfactory. But the important thing about any project we consider is it's our studies that by our, the ISO's planning process studies that identify the needs. And we would need some basis to identify a need and then also the authority under the structure of our process to go forward and identify projects that meet those needs. And so as we get into this, I think there's some logic here as to why it's not appropriate for us to identify what is the need that would drive such a project. Much of it has to do with the question of, well, what need is it serving? So, and we'll get more into some of that when we talk about reliability and policy projects.
Sure.
And logic.
I appreciate that. And I'd just say now that the ISO is conducting a 50% RPS study, and it's looking at access to Wyoming.
That's right.
as an information-only study. So I just not
but
quite sure how
only.
The fact that that's happening and you're not considering the, you know, how the what's being considered.
Right, but information only is different from a process that's actually going to approve a project for cost recovery through the regulated cost recovery mechanism.
All the more reason why the Gateway projects should be looked at to help gain that information. Okay, right. I mean, if you're looking to gain information and you're not going to, you know, push the big button of approval. That seems
okay.
Like the most appropriate time to me,
okay,
to look at those because you're not, you know, the gun's not loaded. You're just looking at things, you know, because you got to access, you know, the study is to access 2,000 megawatts of Wyoming, and there's one for 2,000 megawatts of New Mexico as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if those aren't being looked at now in that information-only study, and I think it could be looked at in the context of the SB 350 study because you did team on the 350, you did all this different
stuff. You're kind of going off topic here. I mean, seriously, this is outside the scope of what we're talking about,
yeah.
You know. So, I mean, I appreciate that point, but we'll have a planner in here later and maybe there'll be some time to get back into it. But I think when I explain the logic of our planning process, you'll see reasons why we don't have the capability of doing that right now.
Sure.
And it would not be appropriate.
I appreciate it.
We don't even have a commitment of another area to join at this point, you know.
No, I understand that. But
we got to move on, Dave.
What What I do want to say, the other comment I had was using examples that have these numbers in it would be very helpful for people considering what these, you know, what your proposal is.
Yeah.
Because without that, it's hard to really think how many billions of dollars we're talking about for California or other subregions.
Understood. But we're trying to not get into billions of dollars here in this discussion. We're trying to talk about principles that would be expandable through the greater Western region if other entities want to join. And for somebody to say, I like that because of the dollars, or I don't like it because of the dollars, to me, is not really a principled discussion. It's really, do I like it or not, based on how it affects my pocketbook. So we're trying to really take a different kind of approach here. So,
and I'd just like to clarify one point. I don't think the SB 350 studies looked at any projects. They looked at transfers of megawatts from certain likely renewably rich areas. So to suggest that the SB 350 studies were looking at any specific project, I think, is not correct, and I don't want anyone to think that was the case.
Okay, there were projects identified and those costs were identified.
Dave, so. We need to move on.
Okay,
thank
you. He was clarifying something, so I just
he gets the last word, he's the lawyer. So
thank you, counsel.
Go ahead, Christina.
Jamie, we have somebody in the queue. Can you go ahead and open up the phone line?
Yeah, hi, this is Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting. I promise this will be quick. There are a couple, and you alluded to this, there are a couple of other criteria you had talked about in terms of what was new and existing. I just wanted to just clarify those. When you talked about new facilities, or the ISO talked about new facilities in the last proposal, it was not only, and the scope of what you're looking at, it was not only projects above 200 kV, but you also had mentioned projects that interconnect two or more subregions or upgrade an existing interconnection, or create a new or upgrade existing interties with an adjacent BAAs. So I'm wondering, are those two, is it just strictly above 200, or are those other sets of criteria still in play here?
The other criteria are not applicable at this point.
Okay.
What new does entail is whatever gets planned through this expanded TPP, which could include things like the things that you mentioned.
Okay,
well, it has to be above 200 kV if we are going to look at cost allocation to multiple subregions.
Okay, so if it creates a new intertie with an adjacent balancing area authority and it's not above 200 kV, then that would be covered under the low voltage tax for that particular subregion where the interconnection.
That's right, or between the PTOs that it connects. We'll look at it as if it's as we do today for low voltage projects.
Okay, so for an internal connecting two subregions, you could look at both those subregions that are connecting. For an external, a new external intertie, for example, or an upgrade to an existing intertie, if it's below 200 kV, that's going to stay within the subregion that's where that new or upgraded intertie exists or would exist. Is that right?
It would be under however we deal with that today for low voltage.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the clarification.
Sure. Thanks, Susan. Is that it? Okay. All right, so the final thing on this page is simply to introduce the terminology of subregions, which you're all probably familiar with by now, but in any event, the ISO area and PTO number one will be a subregion, and then subsequent new PTOs will each become a subregion, and again, it's the new large PTO with a service territory will become a subregion, unless embedded in or electrically integrated with an existing subregion. So this was also some language that people had a lot of questions and some concerns about. So on the next slide, I talk a little bit more about how we are conceiving these terms at this moment. Page 7, electrically integrated or embedded new PTOs. So embedded is essentially that the PTO in question has to rely on the facilities of the subregion in which it's located in order to meet its load. That doesn't mean that it imports all its energy, but simply it can't meet its load without relying on the facilities of that subregion. That is, I think, pretty definitive. Integrated is a little bit more complicated, and we struggled with trying to make really clear, precise definitions of what this would be, but ultimately thought the best approach would be to have to consider it on a case-by-case basis, that there is some precedent for this many years ago with around the startup of our new LMP market system in 2009, this question of integrated BAA came up, which had to do with pricing, locational pricing of imports. And we developed criteria that are in this tariff section I mentioned, and those criteria are to be considered in making the decision, but they are not a formula that says apply this formula and it spits out the answer. But these are criteria to be considered. Now, if you look back at that tariff section, the language of the first two of these sub-bullets is a little bit different, but I've just tried to move the language forward by talking about the peak existing sub-region. But these are some of the ideas. We also mentioned in the paper, I don't think I captured it here, just about how much of its load or how much of its peak load it's actually serving that requires utilizing the system of the subregion. But number of interties between the PTO and the existing subregion, whether there's parallel flows between the new PTO system and the existing subregion, frequency and magnitude of unscheduled flows, and number of hours where direction of flow may reverse from what was the scheduled direction. So these are four out of the six that were listed in that tariff section. Again, this is just criteria to be considered, but it would be a case-by-case determination that presumably the ISO and the new PTO and other parties would try to figure out what the right answer is, and then it ultimately has to go in front of the Board of Governors for approval of the decision as to whether it should be integrated into the existing subregion or should become its own subregion. But in any event, the embedded one would not be able to become its own subregion. It would simply become part of that subregion in which it's embedded. So hopefully this is a little bit clearer. Not that everyone will like it, but we tried to deal with this in a way that seemed workable. On the phone? Yeah.
Jamie will take the question.
Yeah. Hi, Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting. First, I just want to let you know that we're still looking at slide six, or at least on my screen I am. So I don't know if something's going on with the app there. But anyway, I did have a question on slide seven,
the
embedded concept. I think the prior version said that the PTO that's embedded within an existing subregion would have, or if they want to join, they would have the option to either have their own PTO or to be integrated with the subregion where they're embedded or integrated. And I'm wondering, is that still part of the process? Or the current version seems to read that it would be sort of a mandatory thing for them to be in that subregion. So I was just looking for clarification on that point.
Yes, there is no choice. If it's an embedded PTO, by this definition, there is no choice. It becomes part of the subregion in which it's embedded.
Okay, so that earlier one-time option is out, and this is just the way it would be.
It was a one-time option, you know, and nobody took it.
Yeah.
So.
No, just okay. Kidding. Okay. Thanks, Lorenzo.
Yeah. Thanks, Susan.
And Susan, I see slide seven on my screen, so it may be that something happened with your computer. Operator saying it might be frozen, so I don't know if you have to reboot, but just FYI.
Okay. Anyone else on the phone? No. Okay. So slide eight. All right. Again, some assumptions here. The expanded ISO will continue to charge TAC on a per megawatt hour volumetric rate to all internal loads and exports. And here there were numerous comments raising concerns about using a volumetric charge and what that might mean for retail customers, many of whom, especially outside the ISO today, don't pay on a volumetric rate, but pay on a rate that reflects demand, and depending on their load factor, it has different financial impacts. And what our thinking and research has revealed is that the structure of the wholesale tax does not have to either prescribe or constrain the structure of the retail transmission charges that get passed on to end-use customers. In fact, today, under the California PUC, there are rate structures in place at the retail level that allow for demand charges to be part of the structure for commercial and industrial customers, and volumetric doesn't apply everywhere, even though the ISO is still using the volumetric approach in its wholesale settlement process. The way our charge is administered today is we charge to the utility distribution companies. So, and often that coincides with the utility itself, but not always, because in an investor-owned utility territory in California, there can be different load-serving entities who serve retail customers. So within PG&E or Edison or San Diego, there will be the utilities bundled customers, but there's also direct access ESPs who serve customers under the direct access rules. There are community choice aggregators that also serve retail customers, and they have all the roles and responsibilities of a load-serving entity, but they use the same investor-owned utilities distribution system. So it's through the distribution system then that we calculate the, or we get the data to calculate the total end-use load served through that distribution system, which covers all these diverse load-serving entities, to make sure that all the end-use customers, that, or that our wholesale charges reflect the load of all of the retail customers. But then how that goes down to the actual retail customers will be subject to the rate-making proceedings within the California PUC, something that differs from volumetric is perfectly feasible and, in fact, exists. So that basically is where we ended up on this. And we have mentioned in a related initiative that we had going in response to a proposal raised a while ago by Clean Coalition to reconsider the billing determinant in TAC. So we had an initiative called Review Wholesale TAC Billing Determinant, and we got a lot of comments on that after starting it up around the beginning of the summer, and decided that people raised enough issues about this tax structure question that we will open another initiative probably around the middle of next year to think about whether we should change the structure of how we're doing the wholesale and charge on some other basis, combination of demand and volumetric or something else. And I know that in the other ISOs and RTOs, and most of them anyway, they do utilize a demand structure as at least part of how they recover their costs. So we would look into that. But in the meantime, the central question we're dealing with here is the allocation of costs across subregions to the subregions. So our sense is that we can deal with that cost allocation question across subregions and put off this billing determinant question for the next initiative. So that's where we are. Okay. All right, so moving along, slide 9 introduces the new topic, cost allocation for existing facilities, and the whole story is on one slide, page 10, and there's nothing new here. Cost of existing facilities will be recovered via license plate subregional TAC rates, with the subregional TAC charge to each megawatt hour of load internal to the subregion. And we had some discussion at one of the earlier meetings about the non-PTOs. And if you look at the ISO's wheeling access charge on the on our website, there's a list of these entities called non-PTOs that are taking service through the existing IOU systems. What we would propose here that a non-PTO in this future scenario would be paying the same sub-regional TAC rate as the region in which it's embedded. So in a sense, this discussion we had a few moments ago about embedded entities that join the ISO, if one of these non-PTOs were to join, then it still is subject essentially to the sub-regional rate. And if it doesn't, it's still it's getting charged based on the terms of its relationship at the sub-regional TAC rate. Exports and wheel-throughs, though, is where the change is. This idea is not new because we included this idea back in our last paper in May, but we've now got a lot more details about how it would be defined and how it would work. So we'll get to that. But in any event, the exports and wheel-throughs would pay a different rate, which is a region-wide access charge. So if we're going to have different sub-regional TAC rates for each sub-region, we don't want different rates, and we'll come back to a lot of the rationale for that. But anyway, at this point, the exports would pay this region-wide export rate. The points 2 and 3, these numbers reflect numbers in the paper. Each sub-region's existing facilities would comprise what we call legacy facilities so that when a subsequent sub-region joins, they don't pick up any responsibility for those legacy facilities. And instead, the new entity has its own existing facilities that it continues to be responsible for. The high voltage TRR for then the embedded or electrically integrated PTOs, once we decide who they are and they join, then they're simply combining their costs with the costs of the existing subregion, and it's all put into one bundle or collection and out of the subregional TAC rate. Okay. Yeah. Annette.
So this might, this is Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E, just to make sure, about the first bullet under one there. I think you're meaning to refer to the wheeling access rate, not the TAC. Is that correct?
Well, in this future world, the wheeling access charge goes away. Okay, we have a subregional TAC, and we have an export rate, the EAC. Today, they are paying the wheeling access charge, you're right. But in the future, they're paying the same subregional TAC rate that everybody else in the subregion is.
Well, I think that's true today, but we've always called them by different names. But I take your point.
Well, I today WAC wheeling access of charges to applies to both exports and non-PTOs, and I want to make it clear that they'll be paying different rates in the future. Exports will pay one. Non-PTOs will pay the other. So that's why I changed the name. So, Paul, do you want to?
Yeah, Paul from Southern California. And I guess maybe we'll do a deeper dive later, but, like, you know, power that goes to SMUD or LADWP, is that an export or was that, like, the TAC rate or the wheeling charge?
They're external balancing authority areas, so that's an export.
So they would pay the EAC.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, anything that goes to an external VAA.
All right.
Okay, continue on. Okay, now we get into the fun stuff, the new facilities. So what we talked about the last time, two times ago when we had our last proposal out, beginning of June, we talked about a body of state regulators that would have substantial deference over transmission facilities and how their costs are recovered. And we pointed out at the time that FERC Order 1000 requires the ISO to have default provisions in the tariff that would apply in the absence of an entity like that body of state regulators or something else making alternative decisions or taking actions on it. And many parties said, well, tell us what the default provisions are, and of course we have to do that. So what we're doing here is essentially laying out what those default provisions would look like or what we're proposing for them at the moment. And then this other idea of what we called then a body of state regulators has since under discussions in the governance aspect of the regional discussions has been renamed the Western States Committee, WSC, and so that's the term we'll use now. Part of the reason for that name change is that the individual serving on the committee representing the state doesn't necessarily have to be a regulator, whereas the original title kind of suggested that. It's really an appointee from individual states, but a lot of the details of how that's going to work are being worked out in another venue. We'll have some ideas here about the scope of its primary authority, and we'll get to that. And in fact, I believe there's a paper being published later today, on the ISO website that has an initial concept paper about a number of governance topics, including the Western States Committee. So I'll get confirmation on that a little later, but I'm pretty sure it's coming out today. So the WSC is now the new terminology for this. We will talk a little bit about some specific areas in which it would have something called primary authority, that is a decision-making authority that would fit into the process, and I'll get into more details on that. But the actual finalization of how it's formulated, how it works, and all of those details are outside of this initiative. So what we're mainly focusing on right here is the ISO default provisions. And so once we develop those default provisions, we put them in front of FERC, FERC approves them, then they're part of the tariff, and of course, whatever happens with the WSC may modify it, but it still would have to go through a FERC approval process in order to change what the default is. Alexandra.
Hi, this is Alexandra Mackey from PG&E. We struggled a bit with the use of the word default, and we're trying to parse out who has, or where the primary authority versus the secondary authority exists between the WSC and whatever provisions are adopted. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so when I get into the transmission planning process, I think it'll be a little bit clearer, but the basic idea is that, you know, our transmission planning process, assuming we retain structure similar to what it is today, it's a 15-month process. We start in January of one year and end up in March the year after. And there's a whole lot of studies going on and stakeholder meetings, and we're identifying proposed solutions. By around early to mid-December, we've got figured out most of the projects that are going to be proposed in the comprehensive plan for the most part, because the studies are done. And then later in January, we actually come out with a draft plan. And then there's public meetings, there's rounds of stakeholder comments, and then it goes to the board the end of March. During that interval, say the first 3 months of the second year, while the proposed catalog of project is out there, but before the board's made a decision, would be a time where the WSC could exercise its primary authority over the specific areas, and you'll see there's a subset of cost allocation questions that we are initially proposing be their scope, where they could make decisions about cost allocation within their scope of primary authority that would then be part of what gets proposed to the ISO board for final approval. If they don't have any alternative solution to the default, then the default applies. So That's the basic idea. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Christina, anybody online?
No.
Okay. All right, so a new transmission facility may be considered for cost allocation to multiple subregions if it's rated 200 kV or higher. That's the high voltage category. I underlined considered because it doesn't automatically get cost allocation to multiple subregions. It's going to depend on a few things that I'm about to get into. Costs for certain high voltage projects that we'll specify in a minute would be allocated entirely to the subregion where they are built. So some of them will not even be eligible for under this proposal. Allocation to multiple subregions, and the costs for low voltage projects are still allocated entirely to the relevant PTO. So that we're leaving. And we will use our transmission economic assessment methodology known as TEAM to determine economic benefits to the expanded ISO region as a whole and to each subregion. I didn't say in here, but I should say where relevant, because in certain situations, the economic benefits are not relevant to the cost allocation. I'll get into those details in a minute. Now, the ISO is in the process of updating the TEAM documentation. Many parties pointed to the fact that we have really old documents up there. And so there's something, I don't have a date on that yet, but Jeff Billington has promised to come into this meeting later, so we can ask him a bit more about that process and how it's going. Yes?
Dan Williams from Portland General Electric on the merchant side of the business. So is there a point here where you would be looking at allocations to other WEC planning regions for these facilities outside of the new ISO region?
Our planning process as constructed cannot allocate costs to regions or areas that are not part of our planning region. Now, under the interregional provisions, we can collaborate with a neighboring region to define a project and figure out cost allocation, but it would have to be under that construct.
That was pretty much what I was asking, is where in this point you would go to the interregional plan,
right,
and how that may impact then the cost allocation within the new ISO region. Just to kind of, and maybe it should be something that should be in a future paper to kind of identify the links there between the interregional planning and this planning.
Okay.
It's questions I've heard asked from people who've read this but haven't been in the process as closely.
I see. Okay, good point. I can clarify that. But, I mean, the main thing we're talking about here is we're planning for for the larger footprint, and the cost allocation is to that footprint. Okay, Paul?
Paul with Southern California Edison. So the 200 kV, I think in prior documents, there was also the or, if it interconnects to another region, it wasn't necessarily a hard 200 kV line. And so is that then gone?
Yeah, our sense is anything below 200 that we have provisions for low voltage that are PTO specific.
Okay.
And we would stay in that realm.
Okay, so you're using the 200 as kind of the hard line then to make it as easy. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Hi, Brad Mullins for ICNU. So I think we raised this comment previously, but I just wanted to confirm that the 200 kV limit would mean that public policy projects below 200 KV would be allocated to the PTO where the public policy project is located.
Right.
Okay. And, I mean, well, I'll just confirm that. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi.
This is Pushkar Wagle from Plain RCI. Good morning, Lorenzo.
Hi, Pushkar.
Just wanted to clarify that when a non-PTO that is embedded within a certain subregion or part of integrated, integrally part of that subregion becomes a PTO, its high voltage cost would be rolled into that particular sub-region's tag. I mean, that was the impression I had from the earlier proposals, but it wasn't very clear from this second revised straw proposal.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. I think I had it on a prior slide, but yes,
okay,
that's correct.
Sorry, I was a little bit late. So
that's okay. So it would be rolled in once it joins the expanded ISO.
Okay, yes. So it would be rolled into that particular sub-region's high voltage.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
And its low voltage, of course, would be its own responsibility. Yeah. Okay. Did you say someone on the phone? No. Okay. All right. So a little bit about team, and I didn't expect we'd get here this fast. Jeff is going to come in a little while. Jeff Billington from planning. So if we want to get into more details on this, we can. But basically, this is a slide that we went over in the August working group meeting we have. But basically, team is focused on economic benefits that are defined really in terms of benefits to ratepayers from serving load, acquiring capacity, acquiring ancillary services, et cetera. It's production cost modeling, 8760 hours, and looking at production costs for the system. So it will reflect reductions in losses and in congestion and cheaper resources being available in the optimization, capacity benefits that can be calculated as access to capacity that's needed, and all of these bullets here represent essentially ways that the results that come out of team can be split by sub-region so that we can determine sub-regional shares of all of these. And again, we can come back to this if you want to ask more detailed questions, but I'm not the expert, so Jeff will be here. Yeah.
This is Dave Smith with Transwest Express, and I'm not sure if this is a real technical question or more approach question. So I'll ask it and then we can decide whether we need Jeff to answer. We submitted the comment that in addition to these benefits shown here, you could also consider the benefits of investing in a transmission line to access lower cost renewable resources. And I was wondering, I saw the responses that it looked like that's not being considered by the ISO, or there's a reason why that's not happening. And is that accurate, and what is that reason why access to lower cost resources wouldn't be considered as part of the team work?
Well, it wouldn't be part of the team calculation, but if access to lower cost resources is in fulfillment of a policy mandate, then it's the direction of that policy mandate and the entity responsible for it that could drive transmission. And so meeting that, and presumably as the entities responsible for that, so the ISO does not, for example, with 33 or 40% RPS, the ISO is not in charge of how to procure resources to meet those requirements, right? So that's something that's happening by the load-serving entities who ultimately have that responsibility and their regulatory authorities. So we rely on getting information from the regulatory authorities as to how they see procurement unfolding that would drive transmission. We would plan to meet those requirements, but those are not part of the calculation that team looks at. So they ought to be in there in terms of the entities responsible for procurement making decisions about where they want to procure.
Okay, and that differs from the capacity benefits? I mean, aren't the capacity benefits also dictated through procurement that is regulated or, is done
well,
by the same?
Capacity is more a technical reliability quantity that comes out of the RA requirements. I'd say that we distinguish between that and the policy driver, because essentially Resource adequacy is an essential component of reliably operating the system, and there are requirements on all load-serving entities that are part of that, irrespective of whether state has any other policies that may drive the need for transmission or procurement.
Okay, and the reason why Transwest is advocating using the access to lower costs and the production cost modeling to look at this is we're really not certain that other states will set up the same system where a CPUC or somebody else identifies in bright letters the word policy for certain economic benefits versus other ones. And if that's the case, then I'm just not sure everything's on an equal basis for both subregions going forward in the way you're proposing how to do this. So, you know, my understanding is, you know, there is no other state where the word, you know, policy is dictated for certain I don't know what to call it, transactions or transmission drivers.
Right.
That is the same as California. So depending on how that happens going forward is kind of a fundamental basis of how to really examine these different options that you're kind of like, you know, the way it
is. Right. So you're thinking, let me just clarify, see if I understand. You're thinking of a possible future scenario where other states may not identify policy mandates at all that come into the planning, in which case, when we get to the public policy category, only California.
Right. And I'm not saying the other states won't have policies, right? But in California, there's a statute, right? And
right.
And there's a 50% RPS. And then the CPUC goes as far as to say policy is go get it here,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the other, in other states, I think they say, you know, whatever, you got to get to some certain RPS. And then they go and, you know, the utilities maybe look at it and perform IRP work or other things and say, mm-hmm. you know, from a transmission basis, it looks like we should go access this or that, which is similar to what the CPUC is doing. But they don't then in the IRP say this is for policy and this other part is for non-policy. So
okay.
That's where I'm not sure you're going to get the same basis inside and out. Given that you might not get the same basis inside and out, I was thinking that it might be easier to more generically deal with the production team, you know, for the whole area, because you can take whatever benefits are decided in that policy piece but outside the TPP
mm-hmm.
and kind of bring those numbers into some type of analysis so that you're kind of getting it on an even basis.
Okay. I think I see what you mean. Let me just ask. Anthony's been wanting to respond here. So.
Yeah, Anthony at Anchorage with the CalISO. I think if you look at our current tariff for policy projects, it lists, I believe, 10 factors that can be looked at. So to the extent the State Commission didn't identify particular portfolios that it wanted, there are other factors listed under policy projects that can be taken into account in determining, you know, the policy projects that should be recommended. And I think the existing tariff already includes the type of factors that you've listed. So that flexibility, I think, already exists in the tariff to the extent, you know, a state commission isn't saying, you know, we want, you know, resources procured from these areas.
Diane Broad with the Oregon Department of Energy.
We need the red light.
I got it. I think you answered my question, but it was really quick in sort of like a subclause of a sentence. So on the second bullet point, capacity benefits, I see sort of a dotted line to the resource adequacy evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was here yesterday, so discussed, you know, all of the you know, different permissible ways that that the CalISO evaluates capacity. I'm sorry, the term's escaping me at the moment. But my question is for a new PTO coming in, there's sort of a timeline of getting, you know, on board and providing information necessary for satisfying RA requirements. Mm-hmm. And then there's this team process, production cost modeling. Mm-hmm. Just wondering if there's any potential concern about, you know, a PTO coming in who may have had a completely different way of analyzing capacity than the methods that are currently used. And I guess, you know, it reminds me of other processes where there's crossover mm-hmm. between evaluation from, you know, one part of the organization and another part of the organization, and then, you know, you sort of get stuck in this chasing your tail kind of thing.
So if I understand your point, this bullet about capacity benefits, to the extent it and mainly refers to resource adequacy, may need to be updated to account for the future RA procurement provisions and requirements and how it works, right? In other, is that your main point?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is for the new PTOs coming in, I guess it should be clear whether the way they currently have mm-hmm. evaluated the capacity benefit of whatever resources, you know, may be interconnected through this proposed transmission would be accepted, or whether they would have to rework that analysis uniform counting methodology. That's what I couldn't think of, to conform to the
yes.
uniform counting methodology.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. I haven't thought about that in this context, but I imagine that what would come out of the regional RA proceeding in terms of how capacity is going to be counted would probably have to be rolled into how we look at capacity benefits, because that would constrain what needs to be procured or how it can be procured. So I don't have a good answer for that, but I think sounds like I've understood your point. I think I have. Okay, thanks. Yes, Eric.
This is Eric Menzel with PG&E. I think the current STAR proposal is really well organized, and it's a much more mature product compared to previous one. And I just want to comment that the slide you have up today isn't contained. Information is not in the STAR proposal, but it's probably very helpful to have it in there, and maybe even not somewhat expanded with information you're getting back today or discussion, and to revise the proposal before comments are due, because otherwise you're looking for information in two different places and it's harder to comment, and it'd be better in that proposal.
You mean this slide in particular?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That seems like a possibility. Sure. Alexandra.
Alexandra Mackey from PG&E. In earlier stakeholder meetings, the idea was mentioned of creating a separate work stream, perhaps within this initiative, to look at team in more detail and how any changes might apply under a regional construct. Is that still an option or a thought?
It is a possibility. We're talking about that,
okay.
But I don't have anything definite to say. So there's an internal conversation to consider that, because we are realizing that it would be good to get everyone on the same page and common understanding.
Yeah, I think PG&E would support that effort. We're starting to see elements that maybe need to be looked at more closely.
Okay,
yep.
Good. Okay, Dave.
Yeah, Dave Smith with Transwest Express. Going back to my earlier question, with respect to policy, and I appreciate that there's other mechanisms in the tariff to do that. Is there a restriction in including those economics from the policy piece in the team, such that if team's going to be used for the basic cost allocation between mm-hmm. the two, it would seem more robust to include those benefits decided from someplace else? So I understand Tony had the comment about, you know, there's other factors and stuff, but I'm just wondering, is there actually a restriction in kind of putting all those things together in some economic analysis so that it can be used as the basis for cost allocation?
I don't know that there's anything that prohibits doing that. We currently have a methodology that works the way it does. Now, I think fuller discussion of your question probably requires more expertise than I have, and whether we could do that going forward. My understanding is that at this point, the ISO is not considering modifying team. Now, whether we do something different in the future, I don't know. But it sounds like what you're raising is not a simple yes or no question. It would require developing a methodology for how to do it. And, you know, I think it's a much more complicated thing. Jeff, do you want to add anything to that? I noticed that Jeff Billington has showed up in the back, so.
Yeah, it's Jeff Billington with the ISO. At this time, we're not looking to make changes like that to team. We will be going through in terms of an update of the team methodology, but what the changes that you're looking at right now is not something that we're contemplating.
Okay, continue. Anyone on the phone? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to take a few minutes just to give everyone a level-setting review of transmission planning, because this is really then crucial to the rules we want to suggest for cost allocation. For this initiative, we're assuming that the new integrated TPP for the expanded region will retain today's TPP structure. Now, we have said that this TAC Options initiative is not about the TPP. At the same time, in order to talk about cost allocation provisions coherently, we need to have some ideas about how the TPP works. And I think this is a reasonably good assumption to make because, for one, it's been functioning pretty well for a number of years. We don't see a clear indication that it would need to be changed for a larger region. And there are certain responsibilities that it embodies that we have to do on an annual basis, like reliability assessments. So we'll start with this as an assumption that what we do going forward in a larger area looks structurally and time-wise pretty much like this structure. It's a 15-month process that begins in January each year, so there's an overlap of in the January to March time frame where we're doing the concluding piece of finalizing a comprehensive plan while we are starting up the plan for the next cycle. Phase one, which is January through March, establishes what we call unified planning assumptions and a study plan. And the next slide has a little bit more detail on that. Phase two is 12 months, which then is performing all the studies, identifying the projects to meet the needs, developing a comprehensive plan, submitting that plan for Board of Governors approval. And then phase three, which is not really relevant for the cost allocation, is the competitive solicitation. For whatever facility plan are eligible for competitive solicitation, we then conduct that as a phase three. But essentially, the decisions about cost allocation are determined through the end of phase two. So if we look at this diagrammatically, the 15-month process is the blue box and the whatever color that is box, the peach box. So you see, starting the beginning of the year, phase one is unified planning assumptions and study plan. That would be the point at which policy mandates to be considered in this cycle of the process are identified. We put those in and saying, here's what we're going to study in terms of policy needs, specific policies. It's also under the current process where, for example, the RPS policy in California, where the CPUC provides us with their procurement scenarios or portfolios that are going to be utilized in our study process for policy projects. So we're getting all that information and essentially nailing it down by the end of March. There's a stakeholder meeting to review a draft, and it gets finalized at the end of the month. But what we're looking at is demand forecasts. We rely on the IPER, which is the CEC, statewide 20-year demand forecast that they refresh every 2 years. And they refresh comprehensively every 2 years, and then on the in-between years, they do a modest recalculation update. So we rely on that information about energy efficiency projections, what we know about new generation that's going to come on with specific in-service dates, transmission facilities that have scheduled in-service dates that have been approved in progress, we put those in. So all of that stuff comprises what we're looking at over a 10-year horizon. And then, of course, opportunities for stakeholder input. Phase two, then, is where all of the work happens in terms of doing the studies and actually coming up with recommended solutions, and then ending with taking the plan to the board. So it's usually by around December that we've mostly figured out what are the preferred solutions, but it all then gets compiled into a draft comprehensive plan that comes out the end of January, and then there's a stakeholder meeting to review that plan, comments come in, and the final version then gets taken to the Board of Governors towards the end of March. And it's during that period where I was talking earlier about the Western States Committee, where they might come up with an alternative cost allocation for one or more policy projects, and that would then be inserted into the process prior to taking it to the board for approval. Okay, and then this just breaks it down a little bit more to talk about the sequence. And the sequence is really important because we really build the plan in an incremental manner, starting with the reliability analysis first. That is essentially a NERC requirement. We have to look over our 10-year time horizon to identify potential reliability issues, criteria violations. It's all spelled out in detail in our planning process, and identify where we foresee problems coming up in the next 10 years and identify mitigations for those. Initially, what happens is the ISO puts out study results. The PTOs need to identify their mitigations, their proposed mitigations. That information is all shared with stakeholders in September, and then there's a window of opportunity for any participant in the process to propose an alternative. We can also consider non-wires alternatives at that time as perhaps for a piece of transmission structure. So, there's a question there? Okay. So then we get into the policy-driven. We are essentially taking the reliability analysis as done and the mitigations that it comes up with as done and going to be implemented, because then that modifies the underlying transmission system that we're looking at adding to with policy-driven. And then step three, after the policy-driven ones, now we've got additional augmentation to the network, perhaps, if any policy projects have been identified. Then we go into economic analysis, and there we've had specific areas that we've identified for congestion studies or economic studies, and those areas of the grid are identified way back in phase one when we did our planning assumptions and study plan. We candidate areas where there's potential for significant economic benefits to come from a project. So it's those areas that we study in depth to calculate economic benefits. Other analyses, the bottom box, are things that we're doing for other purposes that are not, strictly speaking, inputs to the selection of resources. And then this next one just describes a little bit more detail. Yeah, okay, sorry, go ahead.
I'm David Oliver, Navigant. So the current TPP, they provide a HVTAC forecast in the plan. Mm-hmm. Is it safe to assume that that will continue with subregional HVTAC forecast when the plan is developed?
I would think so. Jeff, do you have any comment on that?
I just need maybe some clarification when you're saying forecast.
within the sub-region.
Well, you provide it's a TAC estimate, I guess, is that includes the newly approved projects. In the most recent transition plan, you provide a how that will affect the TAC in the plan. And so I'm just wondering, I assume that's going to be continued at a sub-regional level in the future?
That's the intent as we're going forward right now, yes.
Okay. Tony.
Lorenzo, help me refresh my recollection and make...
Just introduce yourself for the
podcast. Tony Braun for CMUA. Help me refresh my recollection and because I can't remember some of the chronology of the changes in policy as it relates to both the generator interconnection and the Order 1000 implementation. Maybe Anthony can help here. Were any of the major lines, Tehachapi, some of the other lines that were associated with build out to 33%, policy-driven, formally labeled as such, or were they LGIA facilities? My recollection is the big chunk of them were LGIA facilities. So I'm trying to figure out, in the context of those, I'm trying to think through, you know, have we really applied this strictly in the neat manner that you're laying it out here?
Jeff, can you answer about any specific projects? I can give you a conceptual answer, but Jeff would know the specifics.
Yeah, I'd have to look at some of them, but there's a mix of them. I think some of them were through the LJ, some were through the policy. I'd have to dig out in terms of which ones would fall into which bucket from the previous projects.
Just in terms of the concepts, in 2012 we revised the interconnection process and created this thing called GIDAP, Generator Interconnection and Deliverability, something, what was the A for? Something, allocation, deliverability allocation process. And what that did was it recognized that deliverability status so that these resources being interconnected for RPS purposes could count towards RA, that was, in a sense, a policy directive. And so that those larger, what we called area deliverability network upgrades, became part of the transmission planning process under the policy rubric. So where we had to identify a transmission facility that would support deliverability status for some resources that are procured for RPS purposes, that would be a policy project. Now, I don't know specifically which projects were approved when and which came under the new GIDAP rubric or which were approved before. So to get you those specifics, we'll have to dig into some details. And I don't know if maybe Jeff can take a look. But that's the idea. So that public policy mandate in California included deliverability status, and that's why we said, okay, we need to do that, not just let it be driven by the generator interconnection, but actually take it under the umbrella of transmission planning.
And so that everyone doesn't just think this is some sort of esoteric hypothetical, I can't think of any. I think there's one you approved that the PUC has not moved forward with. So I'm trying to think of things that are actually on the ground, and the reason is, I mean, if we're going to use this as a model, if we're going to port this over to whatever the new process is, it'd be good to be able to use some particular examples of how it worked, and that's why I asked the question, is I can't think of any lines off the top of my head that actually got through your approval process that actually have the footers in the ground.
In contrast to ones that might have come through the prior interconnection process. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Pushkar.
Pushkar Wagle from Freena RCI. By the way, getting back to the earlier discussion, I guess deliverability was never a policy criteria. I think there's a big debate about whether the deliverability of generation in the connection was ever a policy, a state policy. I don't think, because the state policy was also always an energy-only goal. But besides that, I want to go back to the presumption here that the existing ISO TPP tariff should be applicable for the expanded ISO BAA. And there are sort of two parts of it, and I think we touched on one part of potentially different reasons for proposing policy-driven upgrades. In California, we have policy-driven upgrades that are both, you know, associated with RPS portfolios and ones through cooling mitigation. The expanded ISO may have some clean power plan compliance and coal plant retirements, so separate issues. So you could have that separation. The second part is the PTO transmission planning criteria, and that may differ significantly from the ISO's methodology for those planning criteria. Are there going to be any efforts to see whether there are any changes to TPB and it needs to occur in a similar time frame that we have the TAC options initiative that would address those kind of disparities, like the planning criteria?
So you're saying that planning criteria may be different in
yes.
the PTOs,
mm-hmm.
and how would we bring those together?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So one thing is the RPS portfolios and the policy issue, the separate the planning criteria, and I think those also need to be addressed concurrently as we go ahead with this initiative.
Jeff, any thought on that?
In regards to the planning criteria, the genesis of the planning criteria is based upon the NERC reliability standards. There's only a couple of components specific to California. We may need to have a look at those as we go forward, or you have applicable criteria, maybe depending upon the nature of it, may need to be a slightly different in different regions, but we'll have to look at that as we go forward. It's not something that we've looked at as of yet. But like you say, the main planning criteria is based upon the NERC reliability standards, which are mandatory, and which can't change, as well as the WEC regional criteria and all the parties within WEC requiring that. We might need to look at if there's some specific components.
Okay, this is Pushkar Wagle from Finansia again. So what would be the timeline for this? Is there going to be a process that investigates or coordinates those efforts with stakeholders?
Well, my sense at this point, we had talked earlier in the year about having activities to talk about more technical details of transmission planning and interconnection that would start up sometime in 2017. My sense is that that's not necessary to resolve the regional, sub-regional cost allocation that we're
mm-hmm.
talking about here. So that would be a subsequent activity.
Okay, thank you. And getting back to the sort of the broad, I think somebody just cited the ISO tariff that is broad enough to take into consideration the different policy and the other criteria. It would be useful to have the discussion of that particular section within the ISO tariff so that everybody's on the same page in terms of the interpretation of the tariff. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so moving along here, just a little bit more detail about the sequence and the stages of doing the studies. So we start out with reliability projects, and essentially that label is meant to say that the project really just looks at a project that's defined narrowly to meet the reliability problem. It's not really defined to provide any extra benefits. And so there aren't benefit cost type assessment that comes out of TEAM. It's really you got to build something to mitigate this problem. Now, when we move to policy, it's quite possible that a policy solution may somehow meet the need of a reliability project that was identified in the previous activity, in which case we've now got a project that does a couple of things and provides both the solution to the local reliability need and meets the policy objective. We're still going to call it a policy project, But because of this additional complication or this additional benefit, those kinds of things can happen. In other words, the planners are always looking at ways when they get to the next problem they're trying to address as such that the whole package of solutions is the most cost effective. So similarly, then the next, you get to economic analysis, you may modify a reliability-driven or policy-driven project, and for now we call that an economic project, but it's really a modification, or perhaps even it replaces one of those others because it meets the same need. But it's only in the economic realm that it requires what I'll call a pure economic project, I should have this word in here, that that requires a benefit-cost analysis and a resulting benefit-cost ratio that's at least one, that is benefits exceed costs. Now, if we are looking at enhancing a reliability project or a policy project that would have been built otherwise, and we want to enhance that for economic benefits, then the principle is that the economic benefits need to exceed the incremental cost above what the original project would have cost. And as I get into the next slide with the cost allocation, I think that will explain the logic for this as well. Okay, and this says slide 9 for some reason. I don't know why the number didn't change. It's really slide 18. Okay, so we do have a 19, so. Is that right? Well, blame Bill Gates for that. You should be able to move slides from one PowerPoint to another, right, and insert them, and the numbers update automatically. Why isn't it happening? Let's get the legal department to find Bill Gates. Okay, default cost allocation for new transmission facilities. So, first off, in this proposal, we're only going as far as addressing cost allocation to the sub-region granularity level. And many parties commented about entities within a sub-region that may have different responsibilities or areas within a sub-region. And at this point, we've got to start here. We've got to, at a minimum, figure out how to allocate costs to sub-regions. But more relevantly, as you see the provisions we're proposing here, it's really in the area of policy-driven projects where this kind of complexity is the biggest problem. And this is where we're considering a role for this Western States Committee and what they do. In other words, the parties, the states, the affected states, you all get together and you come up with a cost allocation if you don't like what the default rules say, and deal with the complexity that way, because as often with cost allocation, there is some negotiation involved. We have default rules, but we expect that in an area where the governance proposal ultimately provides what we call primary authority over a couple of narrow areas, that the states themselves and their representatives would want to address those areas. So item B is the first actual cost allocation proposed provision, and it says if a reliability project is designed only to meet a reliability need within a subregion, it's that narrow project targeted to the reliability issue, allocate the full project cost to that subregion. And there could be incidental benefits that that come up. Some comments questioned incidental. What we mean is that the project was really defined to meet that narrow problem, and it was not designed or structured to provide additional benefits. So whatever consequences come out in the way of unintended benefits or incidental benefits, not part of the cost allocation. Essentially, it was that subregion in which the reliability problem was identified, so they're going to pay the cost. So simple rule number one. Second simple rule, C, for a policy-driven project connected entirely within the same subregion where the policy driver originated, allocate the full cost to that subregion. And then third, for a purely economic project, and this is a project that arises out of our congestion studies and is not simply taking, or I shouldn't say simply, but is not looking at a reliability or policy project that we had previously identified and saying, let's expand this some way. Let's make it a double circuit 230 instead of single, or let's upgrade something. Because it'll give us these economic benefits. So it's not that kind of thing. It's really a project, a distinct project that arises out of the results of the economic studies. Then allocate shares to subregions in proportion to their economic benefits. BCR, benefit cost ratio, has to be greater than one, so you can allocate full costs in a way that ensures that each subregion is getting economic benefits that exceed cost share. And then E, for an economic project that results from modifying a reliability or policy-driven project to obtain economic benefits, and those economic benefits are greater than the incremental project cost, first allocate the avoided cost of the original project, reliability or policy driven, to the relevant subregion where the driver for that project originated. So it presumably substitutes for what we would have had to build if we didn't somehow enhance or come up with a better project. Then allocate the incremental cost to subregions in proportion to their economic benefits, and that's coming out of TEAM. So on the next slide, I have an illustration of that that gets into a little bit more details about how it would work. So for category E above, I guess the first thing to note is we maybe need to give it a different name. And unlike us, I mean, we usually come up with new names and acronyms really easily, so in fact they get wonderfully complicated, but we haven't yet. But the idea being that we don't want to create confusion. Economic project typically means costs and benefits exceed cost, and it comes out of an economic study and so on. These projects are more like mixed value projects, so we'll figure out if we need to give it another name. But in any event, the rule is what we're calling, what we called in the paper, the driver-first approach of allocating costs, which says first allocate the avoided cost of the liability or policy driver, then allocate residual costs based on economic benefits. And that's really a different approach to cost allocation than what we had presented back in August when we had the working group on this topic. And we took a different approach in the example there, so I'll show you how they differ. But it would have essentially said, well, that avoided cost is part of your economic benefits. Add that to the total benefits that TEAM calculates, and now you've got a total dollar value of benefits, and then simply allocate to subregions in proportion to benefits. So they're really different methodologies, and what we'll see in this numerical example is that the driver-first approach allocates a greater cost share to the subregion that had the driver. And I think that was the logic why several parties commented that they preferred the driver-first approach. So next page has this example. let's say the project we selected is going to cost $100 million. And when we look at subregion A, there's a $30 million production cost savings that comes out of the TEAM analysis. And it also meets subregion A's reliability need, where if we built the narrowly scoped project just to offset the reliability need, it would have cost $60 million and not provided these economic benefits. Subregion B, when we look at the selected project, gets $40 million in production cost savings calculated by TEAM. So already we're seeing that it merits going forward with this project based on the cost-benefit assessment, because we're getting 30 plus 40, $70 million in economic benefits that come out of the team assessment, and the incremental cost of the project is $40 million. So by adding $40 million to the cost, you get $70 million in benefits. Now, how do we allocate cost responsibilities using the driver-first approach, which is what we're proposing? Subregion A would first get a $60 million share because that's what they would have had to build anyway to meet the reliability problem. Then they get 3/7 of the $40 million additional cost. So the residual cost then is $40 million. 3/7 of it goes to Subregion A because they get $30 million in production cost savings. Subregion B just pays a 4/7 share of the $40 million incremental cost. So we get shares of 77 and 23, approximately, rounded off. Going back to the total benefits approach, calling that total benefits means add everything in and you have now a total amount of benefits and you split it up a proportion of the benefits. And this is the version that we presented back in August. You would take the $100 million and then look at Subregion A's benefits, which are the $30 million economic plus the $60 avoided cost, and that's a share of the total benefits of $130 million. And Subregion B would pay its share of benefits, $40 million out of the $130 million. So there you get $69 and $31 million as the cost shares that come out. And clearly, Subregion A, the driver-first approach, is going to allocate more to the subregion that has the driver. Okay, this is slide 22. Okay, now here's where things get more complicated. Policy-driven projects, slide 23, involving more than one subregion. So two scenarios come to mind. There may be others, but these are two that struck us as different enough, common under a common umbrella of complicated policy-driven, because more than one subregion is involved, but different enough that we need rules that cover both of them. So in most cases, both subregions will receive benefits. If a project is built inside subregion A to support a policy mandate of subregion B, and this is something we stated way back a year ago when we started out this initiative, that there will be benefits to another subregion or the place where it's built, and we don't want to ignore that. The driver first allocation method, if we were to try to apply that here, means we really do need to have a really well-defined alternative to what would we do if we didn't build this project. And I think that goes to a number of the comments that we received, that we need to do that. We need to have that kind of alternative so that we can look at things on an avoided cost basis. And I think it goes to some of the discussion we had earlier this morning as well. The question of how to do that, though, I mean, in the case of we've done the reliability studies, we have a reliability project, now we replace it. Well, we had identified a project, and we can associate a specific avoided cost with this project we're not going to build. In the case of where we're looking at something in either of these categories, it may not be that there is a clear, well-defined alternative that is, say, subregion specific. You look at scenario two, policy supports, policy mandates, project supports, policy mandates for two subregions. So do we need to go through a study that says, let's define a project that just satisfies the policy of subregion A and doesn't do anything for B and vice versa? That may be an exercise in something that we know we're never really going to do, and then how credible does it become as an avoided cost to be able to use for cost allocation purposes? So I think part of what we're seeing here is there could be really substantial, controversial methodology questions that make it very difficult to try and just go to the first approach. But then another consideration is that what we are proposing here is default provisions, because this category F is the one that we're suggesting in the WSC paper would be the realm of primary authority for a Western States Committee. That is, here's projects that have been identified in the planning process, say by December of the planning cycle, as meeting needs or and having benefits to more than one subregion. WSC, here's our default cost allocation approach, and if you want to do something different, now's your time, and during that interval before the final plan goes to the board, that would be the time to come up with that alternative. Dave.
Hello, Dave Smith with Transwest Express again. With respect to a credible avoided cost project, I agree this driver first is maybe not the most ideal way to do it, and we have that other discussion about including all the economic benefits. But in this construct, wouldn't a credible avoided cost project be a project funded 100% by the region that has the need? I would think that might be a way to think of that. So,
well, what would that project be, and how much would it cost?
Well, whatever it would cost to access that resource, right? I mean, there's
right, and I guess all I'm saying is, how do we come up with that counterfactual project that we know we probably don't want to build, and how does that counterfactual become really credible to be a basis for cost allocation?
I guess what's the criteria for credibility that you're using?
Well, the criteria I'm using is that when we apply this to reliability projects, we had identified a solution, a mitigation solution for a narrow reliability project. If we don't build that, we have a pretty well-defined avoided cost of what it would have cost to meet that. If we want to take, say, adjacent states like Oregon and California, both having RPS requirements, let's figure out what would be a project that helps Oregon meet its RPS needs and doesn't help California meet its needs. Would we even contemplate building something like that? Or if we did, how much complexity and controversy does that add to coming up with something that says, yes, this is a good enough counterfactual that we'll use it for cost allocation? And maybe there are ways to do that. I'm just suggesting that it seems at this point to be a very arbitrary and controversial process to come up with that counterfactual.
Yeah, I think there is ways to do it. The way I generally would think of it is some kind of overlay system over the other subregion system. You know, I'm not saying that makes sense or economic sense.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you wanted to get to New Mexico, you'd build a 500 kV line out to New Mexico or a DC line or something.
That just connects to that,
yes.
That but isn't networked. You're talking about a DC line?
Yep.
Okay. Well.
So those are ways to do it, but you know, I can understand that you might not, you know, or, you know, is that credible? Or it wouldn't make sense per se to pay 100% for that line in that subregion B
right.
To probably pay for some of that. I'm just saying that can be used as the credible benchmark.
Okay, but once then you get into subregion B might pay something for that, then we're back in the realm of more than one subregion is involved.
Sure.
Right, it's not a project.
So you could look at it that just one subregion is involved, and then the other one is that somebody else is involved, and you compare those two. And the reason why I'm asking about this and want to kind of understand the thinking of the ISO is this same basis is the basis for the interregional transmission project evaluation by the CalISO. There has to be an avoided cost to do that, and we commented, you know, a few years ago that didn't make sense, and I recognize maybe it doesn't make sense, but that is the basis, my understanding, for approving a CalISO portion of an interregional project.
Well, as I understood where that ended up, and maybe Anthony or Jeff can correct me, but that in that interregional calculation, the avoided cost is a part of the answer, but not the totality. Didn't we end up, and Anthony, recall when we were developing the Order 1000 interregional compliance and what the ISO's decision would be based on as to, they're having a little powwow back there. Hang on a minute. You know what I'm referring to? The decision
is Lorenzo, I think for cost allocation purposes, we look at, you know, factors other than avoided costs when it comes to interregional cost allocation. But I think in terms of which project you would select, you're basically determining, you know, what the more efficient or cost-effective solution is, and whether it would be more efficient or cost-effective to take an interregional project compared to the regional project that you would have selected.
Right. Okay. So for the decision to go along with the interregional project, it would have to show benefits beyond what we would have built otherwise, right, in order to be acceptable or sufficient benefits. But then when we actually do the cost allocation to the regions, it's based on more than just the avoided cost.
Yes.
It accounts for other benefits. Yeah. Because I remember we had a back and forth with FERC about that. So
could that, is that same process that you just talked about that works for interregional projects? What's being proposed here?
No, it's not. We're coming up with a default rule here that would essentially be what I call default in the absence of action being taken by the WSC to come up with something else. But you're changing the subject, because I think where you started was with this idea of avoided cost. And all I'm saying about the complexity of this driver-first method is coming up with a credible counterfactual, I don't think, is a straightforward issue. In other words, it's going to be arbitrary and controversial, which is why we are choosing not to go that way for our default rule at this point.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I might be changing the subject a little bit, but to give it context, you said earlier that the interregional projects that are being examined could then get folded into this. And I think if the way the interregional projects are looked at earlier, kind of the basis of it changes, then when you get to an expanded, I'm not sure what the reason for that is or what the driver is.
The reason for allowing them to be considered?
No, the reason for changing the methodology under which they would be examined, you know, as an interregional project versus as a expanded region project in two subregions.
Well, there's one of the commonalities is that the ISO planning process still has to determine what the need is, whether it's reliability or public policy or economics. So the fact that there's a project out there in the interregional conversation space doesn't necessarily mean that when we do our expanded planning process for the expanded region, that project is going to turn up as the best solution to meet what the needs are that we identify in that study process. So all we're saying by allowing it to possibly come in is that when we start this new process, we will start from scratch with identifying what the needs are that need to be satisfied, looking at the region as a whole, which would not have been done before. We've never done a planning exercise for California and Pacific Corps, treating them as one balancing authority area. So looking at that as a whole system now, we identify what the needs are in that area. This project that's been under consideration as interregional may emerge as a good solution, but it may not. We don't know. And we're not going to predispose one way or the other whether that project is the right answer to what a need is. Okay.
Tegan, we'll go ahead and take the question in the queue.
Hi, this is Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting. I have two questions. One, or an observation, I guess, in a question. Scenario one, sort of going back to my earlier question about the 200 kV bright line here, if you've got a policy project, policy-driven project that's built in subregion A to support subregion B, so it doesn't – basically – subregion A sort of has no choice but to accept it sounds like, or it has, even if it's not cost effective for subregion A, or subregion A is basically under the 200 kV line or criterion. Subregion A still has to pay, even though the project's being built to support the mandate for Subregion B, right?
Well, we have, first of all, there is the determination that this project is found through the planning process in which everybody, including Subregion A and Subregion B, are participants, that it's found to be the best solution to the problem. Second, under our default rules, yes, if they're getting benefits, then they would get a cost share.
Okay. Well, they wouldn't get a cost share. They have to, Subregion A would have to pay the whole thing, even though Subregion B was the one that was had the mandate.
Not under our default provisions.
Well, if it's under 200
necessarily.
KV.
Pardon me?
If it's under, the hypothesis is it's under 200 KV. So if it's under 200 KV, it's not.
Oh, under 200. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Okay, but if that's true, if it's under 200 KV and built in Subregion A, just to support the mandate in Subregion B, Subregion A still has to pay, and Subregion B does.
I see. Yeah, I think, yes, according to the rules, that's correct. I guess I don't know whether a situation like that would arise.
I don't know either, but you might consider that. Okay.
Yeah, okay. But you're right. The rules do suggest.
It seems a little odd, and again, it may never happen, but if it did, it would seem a little perhaps unfair to those in Subregion A. Okay, and then my other question was, this whole discussion of the counterfactual or what would have been done otherwise seems to be sort of more intense here than for any of the other things that we're talking about. For example, the policy-driven project that could also have economic benefits. Or, you know, some of these other ones, they are based on the driver-first method. And so are you thinking it would be harder here in some way to come up with the counterfactual for a policy-driven project than for other kinds of projects? Or is it a problem,
basically,
sort of the same problem kind of across the board?
No, I think once you're within, well, if you're entirely within one region, or if it's a reliability project that's narrowly scoped, you know, the engineers would do the study and they'd specify the project in enough detail to get a cost estimate based on standard industry practice. So you've got a counterfactual that emerges because we did the reliability projects first and we had to mitigate all the problems.
Okay,
and I don't think when you get into this realm.
Okay.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Let me let you finish.
No, I was just going to say, you know, in moving into this policy realm, we're not building on having done that kind of thing before. So we would have to essentially add the exercise of, well, let's try and invent something that's only going to serve subregion A or that's only going to serve subregion B, but we'd be trying to invent something and study it in enough specificity to come out with a cost estimate that could be used as an avoided cost for cost allocation. And I don't see that as being uncontroversial enough to get to a conclusion that people wouldn't fight about endlessly.
Okay, so you're basically saying you think it would be harder here because whereas your category E above, you already started with a different project that was there, sort of a base project. Now you don't actually have that here, and that's why you're saying this might be harder to do.
That's right.
All right, and then my last question is here, and I'm a little confused. On Scenario 1 and Scenario 2, are you asking people for comments on these things, or is the ISO favoring one or the other, or I'm a little confused about
that. We're suggesting both of them as the default provision. So, yes, these are part of our proposal. The two bullets at the bottom of the page, yep.
Yeah.
That's what our proposal is. They are both, yes, because they're addressing different cases. But they're, in a sense, they're.
Scenario 2 above. Okay, all right. They're meant to match. I apologize if that was obvious, but they're meant to match the Scenario 1 and 2 above.
Yeah, exactly, on this slide.
All right, great. Thanks very much.
Okay.
I'm done.
Sure, thank you. Yeah.
Hi, Ellen Wolfer, Zero Consulting for WPTF. And that answered one of my questions. I was confused about that scenario one, scenario two. But I'm also still trying to sort out the proposal for these types of projects versus the ones that you had on slide 20 when it's just for a policy project in a particular sub-region.
Mm-hmm.
Because this seems almost opposite. In this case, if a policy project affects two regions, you're first allocating economic benefit, and then you're taking the residual costs and you're sharing it. In the other case, you're assigning the bulk of the cost, possibly, to the policy
or
driver.
Or the whole cost.
Well, unless there's incremental economic benefit beyond that, and then that gets spread based.
Let me go back a minute. Which one are you talking about? C?
For in part E, first allocate the avoided cost of policy
okay.
project to the relevant subregion,
right.
and then any incremental economic benefit gets spread. Or I guess it would be the incremental cost of upsizing for economic benefit would get spread based on economic benefits, and
yes.
those seem completely opposite in a way, and so it feels like
yep.
a bit of a disconnect. And I think what's coming to my mind are the projects that Reddy's talked a little bit about import capability, where there's some constraints if you're trying to bring energy in from outside of California, right when you get inside of California, like at El Dorado and so forth, there's some bottlenecks.
Mm-hmm.
And so those alleviating those might be seen as a policy project, but they could easily increase transfer capability from California to Nevada or California to Arizona or something, which would provide a lot of economic benefit. And so it seems a little odd that in those cases you might assign the bulk of the cost to just one side of an interface versus the other when it has huge economic benefits to both sides.
Okay, so are you in case E or case F now?
In case F, I guess it seems odd to me that if a policy project happens to fall inside, say, one state, that state would bear the predominance of the cost, even if the project had a lot of economic benefits to the neighbor. Whereas as soon as you get to the subsequent discussion about where the policy project bleeds over to another state, then you're more sharing equally the costs. So I'm having trouble myself reconciling such a big change in the cost allocation
mm-hmm.
for a project that might have economic benefits in an area that crosses subregions that are pretty substantial on both sides, but in one case you're assigning it all most of the cost to one subregion. In the other case, you're assigning it much more equally based on benefit.
So let me just go back and just be sure I'm following your point here. Are you suggesting that what I've outlined for E, you would prefer the other approach, which is the total benefits? That is, look at the sort of what I've done in this example on the bottom two lines, actually adding up all the benefits and allocating costs that way first rather than the driver first above it?
I think so. I mean, mostly right now I'm just trying to reconcile for myself the big...
Why they're different?
Policy. It seems like they're very different.
The reason why they're different is because we prefer the driver first approach. But when we get to the context of item F and the complexities, we don't think it's possible to do that.
Oh, well, maybe I can just ask you about that then. Why do you prefer the driver-first approach, in particular for policy projects, which I would think would tend to also have high economic benefits? Why do you prefer?
Well, if the policy originates in a subregion and the line is built entirely in that subregion, that's just the case where we're using the driver-first. And if it's enhanced in some way to provide economic benefits, then we'll allocate incremental cost based on those economic benefits. But absent expanding or somehow enhancing the project, we would have had to build this other one within that area for that subregion's policy.
Okay, well, I'll just maybe make one more comment then, because I don't know that I especially agree. I think in most cases these policy projects are chosen as such because the cost is lower. And the cost is lower because the congestion and moving the energy around is...
Cost is lower than what?
Than alternative ways of satisfying the policy project and policy objective. So if we're talking about, say, 50% RPS, we have to get renewables to load somehow in California. And the reason the policy projects tend to bubble up is because they reduce the cost of moving the energy from the renewable sources to the consumers. But it's mostly congestion-based anyway, and so I don't know that it's as separable as you're saying it between a policy goal and an economic benefit. So I guess I just I hope to push a little bit on that presumption that everything else aside, a policy goal cost should be accrued to the, you know, the state that sets the policy, because maybe there's other a lot of other benefits that are coming with it that you would have seen to the system. That
yeah, but we're still talking about the situation where the policy project is entirely within the sub-region that has the policy driver.
Well, again, right? Yeah, I see that, but it doesn't mean that it won't significantly influence another sub-region if it's close to the border.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, you know, it, of course, if you do the analysis and there's no economic benefit to another sub-region, it would all work out, even if you
right.
did it on economics. But if you talk about these policy projects being right at the border, they're going to influence the seam and not just the sub-region.
Okay.
So
you would want to allocate based on mm-hmm. an economic benefits first. It sounds like where you're going.
I mean, just me sitting here today, it seems more reasonable than having such a big shift when a project happens to sit just inside one subregion versus then happens to creep across the border also. It seems like a big step change in your policy direction for something that's somewhat arbitrary or more continuous than discrete.
Yeah, and I think the part of the reason for the discontinuity is because one of the step changes is it's getting into the area of primary authority for Western States Committee. And when we are getting into the realm now of projects providing benefits to multiple subregions for that are originally driven by public policy needs, that would be a realm where states get together and talk about how to allocate costs. I'm thinking of the examples of what was done in New England and MISO, where they did something like that with state committees deciding on what, how they were going to allocate cost of a set of policy projects that they needed. So it's really moving into that different realm of who's making what decisions, and all we're putting out here is this is the default if you guys don't make a decision.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah.
Kevin Higgins for Utah Association of Energy Users and Wyoming Industrial Energy Consumers. On this last exchange, I would actually like to put forward that we support the direction you're taking on the driver-first approach for the default.
Uh-huh.
It gives us some comfort that policy-driven projects are not going to be turned into vehicles for sort of forced cost sharing beyond what beyond what is reasonable and beyond incremental economic benefit. We actually think you're
okay.
going in the right direction with this approach.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just want to make sure though, because I never did read the bottom two bullets and go over them, that everybody's understanding them the same. So let me just take a moment and do that. In the top half of the slide, I've set out some of the logic, but when we get down to the bottom, what's the answer that we're proposing? So this is the scenario one. A project is built inside subregion A to support policy mandates of subregion B. So the classic case that everybody has been talking about is segments of Gateway that are very expensive. They're inside PacifiCorp. California RPS is the policy driver. How do we deal with that? So our proposal, again, recognizing it's a default and the WSC is free to decide something else, at least how we're currently thinking about what it would do, allocate cost shares to subregions up to the amount of their economic benefits. So we would do the team assessment, figure out what the economic benefits are, and allocate that first, and whatever residual or remaining cost there is goes to the subregion with the policy driver. Now, that's not the driver-first approach, and for reasons we've been talking about, I think doing the driver-first approach in that situation is going to be problematic in terms of methodology and credibility. By credibility, I mean people are willing to agree that, yes, that's a credible counterfactual alternative. Scenario two gets a little bit more complicated now because there's more than one state's policy or more than one subregion's policy involved, so that you can still allocate cost shares to subregions up to the amount of their economic benefits, but then the remaining cost is now not going to just one subregion with a policy driver. It has to go to two subregions, and what we're suggesting here is allocate the remaining cost to the subregions in proportion to their internal load projected for the in-service year of the facility. Again, a default provision that gives you an answer may not be the most desirable, but part of the attractiveness is that it complements what this Western States Committee could be doing to develop an alternative if they don't like the default. And in that venue, some negotiated agreement presumably would come out. Yeah.
David Oliver, Navigant. Does this mean a subregion C, which is not involved in either scenario one or two, would still be allocated costs using the T methodology or not?
I think for consistency, there is the possibility that subregion C could get economic benefits, and that would be part of the study, and it could result in a cost share. Okay.
Hi, this is Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. I have two questions pertaining to the last bullet there on scenario two. Could you clarify the definition of internal load as it's being used here? What it refers to?
I would say it's the same definition we've been using for internal load all along. It would include the non-PTO load that's part of the internal system, but it would not include exports.
And your the theory behind using non-PTO load is what?
Well, that from the definition of embedded we talked about, they're embedded today and taking service using the facilities of the subregion in which they're embedded.
Are you assuming they're bound by the same policies as the PTOs?
I'm assuming that our cost allocation only needs to go to the level of the subregion. And we're going to incorporate a cost share into the subregion TRR that needs to get recovered.
Okay, so I'm moving on to my other question. On your allocation methodology, which uses that internal load, would the ISO entertain the concept of how an allocation that's based on remaining load needing to be served by additional renewable resources? So, for instance, in California, the IOUs generally are already meeting a good portion of their load with RPS, and in the future, perhaps policies will change in other subregions where they have they're further away from meeting their goals. This allocation of simply based on load may not necessarily be reflective of need, and I'm just wondering if you would entertain some valuation of need under policies and not simply load.
Sure. This is definitely open to comments and suggestions. Part of what I would clarify, and I think this is in line with what you're suggesting, that if California has an RPS and everybody in California has done their procurement, then California's RPS is not a driver of a new transmission project, right? Because we've already got all the procurement we need. Just putting out a hypothetical. So allocating a cost share to a subregion based on policy would have to mean that that subregion's policy is driving the need for more transmission. So I think that's in line with what you're suggesting. Okay.
Pushkar Raghu from Clean RCI. Let's consider the example of a project, let's say, that's built in California, ISOBA, to meet non-RPS, let's say, a SONS retirement as a policy or OTC retirement. But that does have benefit to access some renewables for out-of-state entities, LSEs. How would you categorize that specific transmission project? Would that be the original C, or would that be F scenario 2?
Repeat the scenario again. It's built.
Yeah, so it's a transmission project. It's classified as a potentially classified as a policy-driven transmission project, but not necessarily meet California's RPS goals. But
and it's
to meet,
entirely within California.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that would be C.
Even though it does have benefits of accessing renewables that helps meet other outside entities' policy goals?
Well, it would depend on what the policy drivers are that we're using to determine the project. So if another outside party, another state in the other subregion has an RPS policy driver and
right.
California has an OTC policy driver,
mm-hmm.
but we're designing the project to meet both policy needs,
okay.
then it's both subregions' policy needs.
Okay. So in that case, it won't be C, but rather F scenario.
Then
too.
It would be more F scenario because it's
okay.
meeting policy. It doesn't have to be the same policy directive.
Sure.
But the project has to be designed such that it's meeting
right.
the multiple policy objectives.
Yeah, in that case, I don't think I have any better solution, but to just basing it means clearly in this particular case, there would be hardly any economic benefits that I can imagine for that particular project or entities outside California. But basing them on the internal load might not be an equitable solution
okay.
In that regard.
Okay, so definitely take the internal load shares as a very straw man to
right.
respond to and welcome better ideas.
Thank you.
Okay. Alexandra.
Alexandra Mackey, PG&E. Tying back to my earlier question about trying to be crystal clear on the authority of the WSC versus the default provisions, and now in this scenario, the TPP. In scenario one, where a project is built in subregion A to support the policy mandate of subregion B, where primarily does subregion B weigh in on whether the project is needed to support its policy? Is that only in the TPP, or does the WSC have a role in that as well, before you even get to cost allocation?
Yeah, so our current thinking, this is preliminary, and it should be to some extent addressed in the WSC paper that's coming out, but basically the entire transmission planning process should be where we come up with what the preferred project is. And the individual states or regulatory authorities that are responsible for the policies should be participating in that process in phase one to begin with, because it's in phase one where we're going to specify in the study plan what are the policy mandates that this planning cycle is going to address, and ideally get some information from those regulatory authorities as to how the policy may drive transmission needs. And using the example of how we work with the CPUC today, 33% RPS doesn't immediately tell us what kind of transmission is needed in itself until that 33% RPS is given more specificity in terms of potentially, today it's the CPUC that gives us the RPS portfolios that say, well, we want to procure in these areas, and that enables us to evaluate, is the transmission adequate to do that? Now, as Anthony pointed out earlier, we do have a list of criteria that we can use to turn policy mandates into specific transmission need criteria. I would imagine that that all happens in the early phase of the transmission planning process where we're developing the study plan. And then throughout the rest of the process, we have more interactions with stakeholders, and I would anticipate that the state representatives are participating so that by the time we get to what is the project that's being proposed, there's general support that we've picked the right projects. And the WSC's job would be narrowly to address cost allocation.
Okay.
That's the concept at this point. It's not nailed down, but that's how we're thinking about it.
Okay. And then to your point about relying on the CPUC process, to provide the basis for the planning need, how do you envision that working the same way when the projects are regional?
Well, I think ideally we would like to have a process whereby the other states and regulatory authorities that have policies they're responsible to is working with us to provide input into how they see their policies driving needs for transmission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, thank you. And I think you guys did a good job in teeing up this conversation today. I think the conversation would be a lot better if we had some examples and maybe a thought of different alternatives on how to solve this dilemma that you have here. This is one alternative I can think of. I've mentioned another alternative, and but I think that would help move along the conversation a little bit better. This here, the way you're going to proposing to allocate out for category F, I guess, or five projects, you know, it's not driver first, right? And I don't know if it's fair to call it driver last, but I kind of think of it that way, that, you know, these projects are being built on a policy basis, and that policy basis has the thought that there'll be long-term PPAs probably in place for renewable projects that are done for economic reasons. It's not just congestion, as Ellen said. It's really to access lower cost resources versus the alternative of not building that line and accessing more expensive resources, theoretically. So that seems to me to be a very big important driver for some of these projects that are being considered, you know, and again, these are in the SB 350 study as considerations for the savings. And so I think that if you look at the economic savings first and then allocate out on that, those are kind of, I would think, kind of more, I'd say, I don't know if it's more speculative, but it's more short-term market things. You might look at a year. You're not looking at long-term, you know, PPAs and the solidity of that.
Well, we are looking over the life of the project, though, and the resources that allow
that. Yeah, I'm just thinking in production cost modeling, you might look at 2 years and what the market will look like from a production cost modeling standpoint, right? You don't, you know, it's not quite as rigorous as assuming a long-term contract. So I think that not including the policy economics of this is kind of, until the first part is already allocated out on a production cost modeling basis, is going to be controversial, I think.
Okay.
The other thing I can see that happens is, you know, and I mentioned this before, there's a lot of different ways it could happen, but, you know, are these economics, are they overlapping the policy piece or not? You know, if the two states don't think of policy the same way, that kind of creates a different a different calculation that gets done. You know, in the PCM, you're going to be picking up things. I don't know what you'll be picking up, but you might be picking up, like you said, capacity benefits. That might have already been considered in the policy consideration. You know, and so I can see, like, a lot of potential over and underlaps that take place that would lead to controversy when you get to allocating things out. So that's why our proposal has been that you take those policy economics, include it in with all the other potential economics, and then allocate out on that basis. I'm not saying that won't be controversial, right? But it seems like you're getting everything in the same calculation and not doing some of it. And then if there's any more, you know, you allocate out on a load basis. That just doesn't seem to be a way to not have a controversial way of doing it. So that's my suggestion. I think there's a few alternative ways you can do it. You know, you have driver first this way, or a total benefit allocation for both policy and economics are three different ways I can think of to approach this.
What was the third one?
Looking at the total economics of both policy economics and production, economics. You have driver first, and I can see what the problems are with that, and then this way, driver last type thing. And I think the driver, you know, probably not fair to call it driver last, but right, when you build up your transmission need case, you look at policy first, and then you're looking at economics to then go back and allocate on that last part you looked at. You know, just, you know, I think it'd be a good conversation to have with the types of folks who would be on the WSC and others about, you know, how they think about that. And I think some examples might be helpful. You can hypothetically think about what the team benefits are for a given, you know, category F type need, and then what the policy need is, and kind of play with that a little bit under these three different scenarios and help move along the conversation.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
David Oliver, Navigating again. I'm not sure how often this scenario come up, but would it be correct to assume that for reliability projects that involve more than one subregion, you would be proposing the same kind of idea, the same kind of allocation?
For reliability, pure reliability project. I mean, what my understanding is that's a pretty rare, if not impossible.
I don't know.
Event.
I was just curious.
Yeah. But I guess conceptually, we would have to figure out some way to allocate to both. Yeah, probably proportional to load. Yeah. Okay. Move on. Competitive solicitation. So here, this, I believe, is also somewhat of a revision from where we were in the last proposal. Basically, what we're saying at this point is that all new transmission projects rated 250 kV or greater of any category will be open to competitive solicitation. That is, irrespective of whether their costs are allocated across multiple subregions, simply by virtue of being planned through the integrated planning process that kicks them into eligibility. With the exception that we already have in our tariff that applies today, when it's somehow upgrading an existing facility that's already part of some PTO system. the tariff language is reproduced there, but basically it means it's an existing facility, part of a PTO system already. We're going to upgrade that facility. Then that PTO will construct and own it unless they reach some other agreement with a project sponsor. But anything that's really a new project is going to be open to competitive solicitation. And we had, in the previous proposal, talked about this question of, you know, it only becomes subject to competitive solicitation if it is going to get cost recovery from multiple PTOs. And several parties commented that that really creates different regimes in California, say, where there are multiple PTOs that are sharing the high voltage TAC rate compared to another subregion that might be entirely one PTO, a definite asymmetry in what's open to competitive solicitation. So we've essentially said, well, you know, we don't want to stay on that path. We really want a level playing field for competition across the entire expanded BAA, and so therefore this is the way the proposal reads now. And then slide 25, two provisions that were met with very broad dislike in previous comments. We had a proposal to recalculate benefit and cost shares periodically. At one point, we started out doing it frequently. Another point, we said, well, maybe only when a new subregion is created. At this point, we're saying, let's forget it. And really, just once the cost allocation is determined at whatever state it's determined, typically that will be at the time that the plan is approved, that's the cost allocation that we stick with, and it eliminates the uncertainty as to how it might change in the future. And number 12, we also had a proposal to allocate cost shares to a new PTO that joins later, PTO number 2 or number 3. We've got an expanded planning process. We've got an expanded ISO already by virtue of PTO number 1 having joined. So the process is up and running, but PTO number 2 or number 3 was not really a participant in that process, and we had originally said, well, they could sit on the sidelines and wait for a strategic moment to join when the planning process approves a facility that they're going to get benefits from, and then join afterwards and have no responsibility for those benefits. We see that as still potentially a problem, but we also see the countervailing argument that to the PTO that was not part of the process, it looks like existing facility because it wasn't decided in a process in which they were a participant in. So we're dropping the earlier proposal and simply say, whatever entities are part of the planning process at the time that project is selected and gets approved in the comprehensive plan, they're the ones who could be allocated cost shares, and we will stick with that. So I see a hand up there.
Yeah, Dan Williams from Portland General Electric, and this is just probably my ignorance of the Order 1000 process, but going back to number 10 of the previous slide, how much is that in line with just kind of straight down the pipe with what FERC would be expecting, or kind of what's been your consideration of how this would look to the federal regulatory body if you propose to do it this way?
Our assessment is that that's highly consistent with Order 1000 and their desires for allowing opportunities for competitive parties to build transmission.
Okay. So this and the slide you're just on seem like they're kind of path of least resistance with FERC?
I believe so. John, do you have any thoughts about that? I'm pretty sure that's very consistent with Order 1000. Anthony, I noticed, just left the room. He's the expert on that. But we've talked about it, and we think this is very aligned with Order 1000. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, Dave Smith with Transwest Express. I think, you know, all these
these three items here make a lot of sense. I just want to point out that in item 12, I imagine it's still possible that that third PTO could participate in an interregional planning process ahead of time. And so if you start thinking about accessing New Mexico, mm-hmm. you know, maybe PNM is on a different time frame to join the ISO than the need is to access that. And so, you know, for any commenters that think this is doesn't make sense or does, you know, there is the opportunity through a reasonable interregional transmission process that you know, they could still acquire some of those costs if that makes sense.
That's right. And that's a good point. This does not preclude any kind of arrangement like that. Yep. Okay. Anybody on the phone? Oh, okay. We're going to keep going. Hey, we might get done before lunch. Region-wide export access charge. This is the last major topic. So here we're picking up on something we started to explore in detail at the working group in August, but making a significant modification in what we're proposing regarding the allocation of revenues. So a single region-wide export rate for all exports. We're calling it Export Access Charge, EAC, giving it a different name because we don't want to muddy the water by confusing what today is called the Wheeling Access Charge, WAC, which is going to apply a little bit differently. Each megawatt hour exported on high voltage interties anywhere in the expanded ISO. The idea being to avoid creating incentives for parties to shift where they're exporting from the system in a way that is really just chasing the lower export rates that would occur if we just use the subregional TAC as export rates in each subregion. It would differ, number 15, it would differ from today's Wheeling Access Charge, which is why we're giving it another name in some important ways. Today, the ISO does charge the WAC to internal load of non-PTO entities that are embedded within the ISO BAA as well as to export. So you can see on the website where it talks about rates, there's a whole document up there that lists the Wheeling Access Charge and all of these non-PTO that are paying it. Under this proposal, we would include the non-PTOs that may still be existing in that status as paying the same sub-regional TAC rate. Now, today it amounts to the same thing because our export rate and our internal rate are the same dollar value when we calculate them, just by the way it works. So today it's saying when we go forward, let's distinguish them and treat the internal ones because they are inside the service territory of the ISO, they're using that system, they should be paying the subregional rate. So that's why, excuse me, we're not using the name WAC at this point to make it clear that it's a different thing. And then we go to the EAC rate as the load-weighted average of the subregional license plate rates for the two subregions, 1 and 2, so it's simply you add up their TRR and you divide by the sum of their load. And this is the same proposal that we had put out in the past at the working group meeting. Now, there were many parties that said, well, we ought to be using a higher rate. There were also many parties that said we should use a lower rate. Some, in fact, said that lower rate should be zero. And our sense at this point is that having something that really balances the different license plate rates of the subregion is preferable. Part of it is to try and maintain a reasonable balance between how much of the transmission revenue is requirement is recovered from internal load versus recovered from parties who are exporting from the grid. To not see a dramatic change in that overall balance in terms of the revenues that are being collected, which if we went to a much higher rate or a much lower rate would shift that considerably. Yes?
I don't know if now's a good time for
general comments or not. This is Dan Williams from Portland General Electric. But I know we've had a lot of discussions over the last year and in other forums about the role that export fees play in the overall market. And I guess I would like to see there be still a door open to the possibility that stakeholders, the MSC, maybe even the Western States Committee, decide that there are public policy reasons that export fees should be changed that sort of trump maybe some of the other reasons that we've explored here. And just kind of circling to the some of the SB 350 studies, I think it became very clear that increasing the intertie exports, even in the bilateral market, has a significant benefit, whether, you know, on a potentially on a different timeline than what a fully expanded ISO footprint would be when thinking about the entire WEC, and thinking about the fact that even if, you know, in the first instance, if it's both Pacific Corp BAs or PTOs that join, that there still will be a significant amount of entities with flexible capacity who could be part of the solving the public policy goals if we can find a good way to use the intertie capacity more flexibly and in greater quantity than what we're doing now. So kind of a long way of saying that just I would like to see it maybe be something that's carried forward as more of an open question that should be studied at a future date or maybe brought before some other committees as to whether reforming the export access charge or looking at eliminating it might meet some other goal and dwarf the lost transmission revenue that may be expected from that.
Okay, so by reconsidering it, you mean making it much smaller or eliminating it?
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm going with it.
Okay.
Just thinking about if there are certain areas or certain conditions where it would make sense to look at reforming that as a way to increase the amount of intertie exports. And I know it's a pretty complicated question and goes into multiple ISO initiatives, but just the way that it's kind of presented now at this point is that it's shut the door on that. So be something to consider keeping open in the future.
Okay. I did mention earlier that we're planning to start another initiative probably around the middle of 2017 to take up what we had been talking about, this proposal by Clean Coalition to change the billing determinant. We just closed that initiative with the intent of a more comprehensive review of TAC billing determinants. So I wouldn't exclude the possibility that your point might be part of the scope of that subsequent initiative.
And then just one other kind of question here that circles through the rest of this is just if you've had any discussion if this export access charge and sort of the differentiation that it would bring, whether that would materially impact the results of the SB 350 study when it comes to, you know, the removal of hurdles through the regionalization and what benefits that brought versus other benefits. Just kind of if you talked about that internally, as if this is a material change to the sort of the assumptions underlying the benefits calculations.
Good question. I'll have to inquire about that. I don't have an answer for you immediately.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. This is just an explanation of something about how things work today in relation to the export revenues and the TRR. And I want to make sure everybody understood this. So, and we covered it in the paper, but basically, the way it works today for purposes of determining TAC rates is that the revenues collected from the wheeling access charge in 1 year are carried in a balancing account that then become an offset to next year's TAC rate. That's an accounting device that we use now. I don't recall the origin of how it got set up that way, but it makes sense, at least initially, to consider that it would be sustained as an approach. And essentially, if we apply this to sub-regions, we could retain that same idea. So I used here in my notation a 1 and 2. It's all talking about one sub-region, but it's a 1 and 2 to indicate years. So EAC Rev 1 is the sub-region's EAC revenue share in year 1. And I haven't talked about the formula yet for revenue share, so it's just getting a share of the revenues that we collect based on that weighted average rate, and we'll get to calculating its share next. TRR 2, then, is that same region's high voltage TRR for year 2, and that comes from the fundamentals of, you know, the embedded cost of the facilities, the maintenance and operation, everything that goes into what you might call a gross TRR calculation. L2, the subregion's projected internal load for year 2, and then TAC 2, what would be the subregion's license plate TAC for year 2. So the way we calculate then the year 2 license plate rate, TAC 2, is to take that gross TRR collection calculation, subtract off what did it earn in EAC revenues, or today it would be WAC revenues for the previous year, and it's that net amount that's divided by the load to determine a rate, and then going forward that rate is used in all calculations. So that quantity, I'm just calling it the net TRR that needs to be collected in year 2, and we're going to plug that into the calculations in the EAC for year 2 as well as the license plate TAC rate. Now, in the next couple of slides, I'm assuming that we're doing this, but I'm not getting into the all the details of the numbers. I think in a subsequent paper, or maybe when we put something out, it might be worth to go through a two-year example or multi-year example to show how it rolls over. But initially, I just wanted this to be in background, and then we'll assume when we get to the next one, slide 29, and we get to the calculations, that this is the way we're handling the accounting for it. So point 18 on slide 29 says the ISO proposes that EAC revenues be allocated to subregions in proportion to their net TRRs. So for two subregions now with export quantities E1, E2, we've got total revenues that are the sum of those exports times the EAC rate. And then the subregional shares would be subregion 1 shares, total revenues times the ratio of TRR 1 over the sum of the TRRs. Again, these are the net values described on the previous slide. In contrast to this, at the August 11th working group, we suggested a different method, which allocated shares to subregions based on the volume of exports from each subregion, actually what went across their interties, times their subregional TAC rate. And that gave the formula you see at the bottom of the page, and that was the one we used in the example at the working group. So on the next slide, we compare both of these with some real numbers. These numbers are in the paper. We also use them for the working group example, where for CAISO subregion 1, these come out of our TAC rates that are posted on our website. There's a document dated October 19th, 2015. It has numbers in it. And the TRR is the one that is already offset by the amount of the WAC revenues. Pacificor is subregion 2, and this comes from the TAC options model that we posted back in February. So in this case, slight glitch, we have not done that export revenue correction to their TRR. I don't know how much it would be, but we want to use the numbers more to illustrate the methodology, but I'll warn you, we didn't have the info to calculate how much we should offset their TRR. So we're pretending that we've done that. In any event, its load is about a third the size of the CAISO load, and its TAC rate comes out to $4.12. Now, these are just the 2015 rates, so they're not up to date, but again, just to illustrate the method. And a much higher volume of export megawatt hours, 35 million compared to 2 million for the CAISO region. Using the formula for the weighted average rate, we get $8.37. And then when we consider now how do we allocate the revenues under these two methods, we got to recognize that when we form an expanded balancing authority area, certain amounts of export volumes are going to go away. At least a small piece of that is what is currently interties between CAISO and PacifiCorp. And that was a relatively small number by our previous calculations that we had in the working group presentation. But in any event, that's an intertie that becomes an internal transmission path, and there's no exports collected on that at all. It's simply collected subregional TAC at the location of the load. But in addition, there will probably be some significant reduction in PacifiCorp's megawatt hour volume of exports because with the combination of all of PacifiCorp's territory into a single balancing authority area, some significant amount of the contracts PacifiCorp uses to move power between east and west that are contracts that are transmission usage over paths that are not part of the balancing authority area and won't be specifically part of the ISO-controlled grid in the future, but those contracts could be scheduled through the region-wide optimization that the ISO market performs. And in that case, because we are scheduling over those contractual rights, there would not be an export and import involved. So and the answer to this isn't known yet because there's a parallel effort going on about looking one at a time through all of the existing contracts, which ones convert to ISO operational control, which ones may stay under the existing transmission contract rubric. So just guessing, taking two alternative scenarios that PacifiCorp's megawatt hour volume of exports drops by 25% or by 50%, third scenario being it doesn't drop at all, which we know is not true. 50% is probably as far as it goes, but I don't know that for sure either, but these are just illustrative. So if we consider those scenarios, what happens with these two methods is then shown on slide 31. So across the top, you see the three different scenarios and different PacifiCorp export volumes, the 35 million being 100%. And then what are the revenues that are collected in each case based on the formula? We have the weighted average rate for the EAC rate, and then we have the export volumes on which that rate is collected, and so that we get those revenues. Now we use the next two lines are the same numbers that we presented in the working group in August. What if we allocate revenue shares based on export volumes and subregional tax? And what you see is those two lines of numbers where notice that, one, PacifiCorp gets a way bigger share of the revenues in all three cases, but number two, that the CAISO share is not too sensitive to the reduction in megawatt-hour volumes from PacifiCorp, whereas the PacifiCorp share is very sensitive to that volume. Makes sense because we're weighting by export volumes. And then the next two line are the TRR weighted shares, and now you see the shares relatively reverse. And now both shares are pretty sensitive to the reduction in export volumes. And in fact, going from 100% down to 50%, you see about a 50%, close to 50% loss of revenues for CAISO, close to 50% loss of revenues for PacifiCorp. So they both share that sensitivity to export volumes based on weighting by the TRR. So those are the options. The bottom line was something that we had in the August report. It simply said, how much is CAISO getting from export revenues today? Now, this is not the complete WAC collections. It's the ones that actually come from exports when you set aside the internal non-PTO entities. So just to give you an idea of what's export volumes and dollars, rather, from today's region. Yeah, question.
Kevin Higgins for UAE and WIAC. I guess I have some questions and some concerns. Recognizing that a fair amount of the PacifiCorp exports as measured in this analysis would go away because it's internal to PacifiCorp. I mean, I realize that. And maybe the case that would be more relevant is even a more extreme case than you've got here, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question is what caused caused the ISO to propose something different from what was proposed before in which the exports were tied to the volumes being exported from a particular subregion and go to sort of a TRR weighted share.
Yeah. So I think the main reason is, there's a couple of factors. One is that we wanted to preserve in both areas a reasonable balance between the volume, the share of the revenue requirements that's paid by internal load versus paid by exports. And in the case of the export weighted shares, it becomes really a huge shift to exports paying for PacifiCorp towards exports paying accounting for a bigger share of the TRR recovery than internal load. And it seems like the TRR weighted creates less of that distortion. I think that's the main, if you want to call it a distortion.
It causes some concerns in my mind. I mean, I think that the analysis you do on this table is an interesting test of reasonableness, but I'm sort of struck by the fact that you have an $18 million actual for 2015 for CAISO, and it seems to me what one would be testing here would be to say, okay, you know, if we had a flash cut. And if we'd gone back to 2015 and had an expanded regional ISO, how would the numbers have changed? Mm-hmm. Assuming that you can correctly capture what PacifiCorp's true exports were as a distinct from internal transfers between PacEast and PacWest. And so I would say what one would be looking for as an initial step of reasonableness would be if the CAISO 2015 revenues were relatively unchanged from what they would be, because you know you're starting with each system sort of bringing its existing resources to the table. It's PacifiCorp obviously has a series of export relationships that are happening now, I would say, okay, if we flash cut, you know, if we had done it in 2015, if the CAISO revenues were relatively constant from what they in fact had mm-hmm. been, that would strike me as sort of passing a reasonableness test. But instead, you know, under the prior way you had proposed it, the CAISO revenues were about double. Again, some of it is maybe distorted by PacifiCorp exports, you know, $32 million versus 18. But then, of course, under the proposal that you now have, it's dramatically increased to $141 million. I mean, not quite 10 times actual, you know, a significant mm-hmm. significant degree of magnitude above where it is now. So it would seem to me that right off the bat, if these numbers were in any way representative of PacifiCorp's actual exports, there'd be a significant benefit shift just by virtue of methodology from the status quo. And I guess that raises some concerns.
Well, I guess we don't know that, because I think if applying your reasonableness test, shouldn't we also look at what is PacifiCorp earning from export revenues today and how much has that changed?
Yes,
and
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, so, and I'm not sure what methodology we can use to actually determine that because they don't charge in the same way that we do today. So it may be possible, and I think we should look into that.
Right.
But we'd have to look at impact on both regions symmetrically.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
The only information available on the table was Cala.
Yeah,
so,
you're right.
But yeah, I yeah, looking at PacifiCorp would also be reasonable.
I think that's an interesting idea. I will have to look into how is it possible to come up with an estimate of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Paul.
Paul Nelson from Southern California. And I saw the change actually quite differently. I was thinking more of it as expansion, as California. If California comes completely surrounded, they have no exports. And that was one of the shortcomings with the problem. The prior one is, well, they have no measured exports, but it's going to another, their neighbor, who then exports it. Because you couldn't say that the California transmission system is not supporting that export, especially in light of what we're seeing with forecasts of our renewables, that, you know, California's been truly a big importing state that could flip in the 2020s and become a big exporter. So that's what I thought was one of this change was looking at trying to resolve that situation, is where a situation where a PTO is completely surrounded.
Mm-hmm.
Yet this would allocate some of those revenues.
Okay.
So I saw it very differently.
Okay.
But it does have some interesting, revenue changes.
Make sure to write up that logic in your comments. Yeah.
Dan Williams from Portland General again. And just circling back though to how you started either this section or the one before, you're saying you're trying to make policy decisions that weren't just based on, you know, instant numbers, given that, you know, you could see additional PTOs and then these numbers may shift significantly, especially if it was, say, you know, Arizona or Nevada coming in next. It would change the export situation again considerably from where it is today. And so I was just encouraged to try and stick with that principle and think about the role that exports play in these markets and maybe think about the role that exports play as sort of a, you know, economy energy balancing coming out of PacifiCorp right now for the non PacifiCorp to PacifiCorp trading, but for say other folks who are presumably be buying from PacifiCorp from one of their embedded entities to help them, you know, balance out their load shape. And to kind of circle back to the principles rather than just looking at the numbers and going, well, this kind of looks like rough justice, so this one looks okay because the numbers look okay on the calculations that we've done now. Just thinking they could add in the next set of numbers, they could shift significantly and then may feel differently about it. But if it's principle-based, then you have something to fall back on.
So what would be the principle that you would suggest is missing here?
Well, I would just say kind of going back further back on it, one of the reasons that you said we needed to have a single rate across all of the PTOs was to prevent people from sort of deciding that they wanted to pull energy out at one point versus another.
Mm-hmm.
And even maybe even to look at that and see what the economics are on the other side of that deal and why people may still choose to export from one intertie versus another given the transmission rights that have to be purchased on the other side, maybe some of the LMP assumptions, congestion assumptions, some of those things that may actually make it be reasonable that you have, if you're going to charge export fees, that you maybe have different ones in different parts of the of such a large footprint.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? No? Wow, I think we're getting down to the end. Oh, Pushkar, you want to?
Pushkar Wagle from Plain RCI. So the fundamental premise for wheeling access charge is when all those exports are using the entire transmission system of that particular BA, right? That's how we do today.
As we're doing it today, yes.
And the notion here would be when you're proposing something like TRR weighted, is that would be using the entire existing transmission system at that point of time within the expanded ISO BA. I thought that was sort of did that come into play when you proposed TRR?
It hasn't been an issue because we've had one high voltage rate that's constant across the whole system already.
Right.
Right. So now we're going to have different high voltage rates, and if it is a legitimate reason to say we should have a single rate, then there's two questions, and I'm not sure which one you're going to. One is the calculation of what the weighted average rate is, or whether it's weighted average or something else. And then two is allocating the revenue. So
I'm going with both. So
okay.
When you look at the EAC, yes, I think it does take into consideration when you do the load-weighted aggregation to calculate EAC, it gets into that. And in terms of allocation, you're basically saying, you know, these are the costs associated with that existing transmission, and therefore it should be commensurate kind of thing.
As
okay.
load is paying.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
David Oliver now again. Do you know how currently unwilling revenues are allocated back to the PTOs? For their revenue required to be offset against their
revenue? California in the current type
currently,
system?
Yeah. Currently the export revenues.
They are getting revenues based on an intertie by intertie basis. If whatever PTO controls the facility, the volume of exports on that facility, they get back wheeling revenues in proportion to the volume on each facility that they own. And where there's shared ownership, there's a share of the revenues.
Okay.
That's the method. Yeah. Yeah,
Lynette. Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. You mentioned earlier that some work is being done to analyze PacifiCorp's current export transactions. Do you know when that information might be available to refine this example?
I don't. I think what I meant to say, if I didn't say it, is it would be good to figure that out, and I don't know yet how or whether the data is even available to do that. So we will look into it, but I can't promise that we can actually do it. It might have to be a very crude estimate. I don't know. Because they pay on a different basis. So, but we will look into it. Okay. I think there's – whoa, who did that? One more topic. This is mentioned at the end of the paper, and I'm just mentioning it because many people have asked about it. In our infinitely creative ways of inventing new acronyms, we've come up with something that I won't try to pronounce because it sounds terrible. Generator Interconnection Network Upgrade Cost Recovery. There is this initiative going on right now, which asks the question about low-voltage interconnection-driven upgrades and whether they are qualitatively different to simple low-voltage upgrades that come out of the transmission planning process by virtue of the fact that they are caused by generators choosing to locate, which is not really under a planning process. Essentially, the generators pick where they want to locate for a variety of reasons. They interconnect at the voltage level for a variety of reasons. But there is no comprehensive transmission planning look at where do we want generators to interconnect and how to upgrade other than the policy-driven part of it, which doesn't go to low voltage. So the question is, should they be treated differently? And I don't want to get into all the arguments about whether they should or shouldn't, except to make the point which parties have asked about is, how does this relate to the current TAC Options Initiative to say that whatever comes out as a result of that initiative should probably become part of the policy that we apply throughout an expanded BAA. Sometime next year, we will take up a more detailed discussion of both the transmission planning process and the generator interconnection process, but we do expect that whatever the rules and procedures and so on apply there would be maintained. Now, we can revisit that next year if possible, but at least our initial take on it is, as you're looking at that initiative, if you're following this other one, follow it with the expectation that what comes out there would become part of the approach the ISO takes on a region-wide basis for the expanded region. Tony.
Lorenzo, Tony Braun for CMUA. Have you given any thought to taking a look at the other potential PTO systems? I certainly am not familiar with their systems from a configuration standpoint. We certainly think we have an intuitive understanding of how this new possible policy proposal would affect things in California, but it sounds like it could be a major issue. Is there any insight into the system configuration of PAC that would lead us to the conclusion that there would be more or less low voltage interconnections on their system?
Good question. I don't know. And I will check in with the team that's working on that to see if they've done any such work. But
maybe I can thank you. I understand that was a hard question to answer. Has there been any thought, John, to, in discussing issues associated with the TCA, where they would be transferring control? That might answer the question. What voltage level?
So as far as the ISO having operational control, we would be using the same functional tests, as we do in the ISO's current balancing area, which, as I understand, and our, planning folks and engineers would be better at answering, would include, obviously, all the high voltage, all the 200 kV and above we're talking about here for cost allocation purposes. And it would also include the lower voltage transmission facilities, certainly down to the 112 type range. I don't know. There may be areas where it does go to the 69 kV. Hopefully it doesn't go any lower than that. But, again, we haven't gone facility by facility. But it would be the same criteria, probably end up looking, be the same application to the Pacific Corp system, how it would shake out in the end, I don't know.
Okay, then. We're at the end. Next steps are simply comments. So 3 weeks from today, comments. We will get a comment template out in the next few days, early part of next week. Whatever we do next, we will announce shortly. We are thinking about having another working group meeting just to talk through some of the more of the details of transmission planning and team, because we understand there is a desire, especially for parties who are not part of the California ISO system currently, to understand those things in a little bit more detail. So we're talking about that. We'll try to get an announcement out soon. But other than that, that's it. Thank you all for being here and participating.
And I just want to let you all know, we did record today's meeting. We also recorded the regional RA meeting yesterday. So we'll make those recordings available on the initiative web pages after we receive them from AT&T. So look for them next week sometime. And then if you're involved with the regional GHG compliance initiative, we have a workshop here on the 13th. So if you're planning to attend, if you could just RSVP, we'd appreciate it. And then Lorenzo also referenced the WSC proposal. That's actually going to be published today along with the second revised proposal for regional governance. So if you're following that effort, look for a market notice on that as well.